they would pick a young man at the height of his virility, appoint him king for 1 year. During that time, he could do or say or command whatever he wanted. The priesthood was always there to make sure he commanded the right things, have any woman that he wanted, and at the end of the year, he was ceremoniously sacrificed upon a rock, his heart ripped out, his body dismembered into 14 pieces and scattered over the land. And this is where the legend of the Osirian cycle began. It was to ensure the fertility of the crops of the next year. And young men would volunteer for this in their patriotic duty to their kingdom, to their family, so that they could have prosperous years.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 18th of June 2021, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in famous Camberley, Surrey, right under the nose of the British Army. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own many of the transmitters and cartel-run printing presses in the Fourth Reich today. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In part two from the COVID-secure G7 at Cornwall's Carbis Bay on Prince Charles' Great Reshaft Duchy Land to the double SS NATO HQ in Brussels. Well, that's if you look at it from above. It's two of the Zig runes, or say four Zig runes, that were used to make the SS. That's the NATO headquarters planned from above in Brussels. And then to the greatest tax haven in the world, in Geneva, for a three-hour head-to-head with the undisputed and popular king of Russia, Vladimir Putin. Martin and I have been doing commentary for Russian and Iranian channels, satellite channels, so we'll review that in part two. Also, closing down the Hong Kong press in a more subtle way than is being done here in the UK. Very unsubtle, isn't it? And the BBC has shown us all what happens when a broadcaster only does what Big Pharma lobby tells it. The giant Chinese Communist Party control in China, Big Pharma control in the UK. Same difference? And on to COVID, and we have an exclusive interview with 1970s Ladbroke Grove Maida Vale squatting guru, now outspoken brother of the ousted Labour leader and challenger of the pro-nuclear, pro-road pricing climate change agenda. That's Piers Corbyn. We speak to him from his latest squat, Tooting Police Station. I spoke to him last night. And also, a definitive ivermectin paper is published in Nature magazine. Well, after about 60,000 people have died, allegedly, unnecessarily here in the UK, and something like 150,000 in the United States, oh, it's about time something was published in Nature about ivermectin, this banned substance that if you even so much as mention it, certainly on my channel, you get deleted off of YouTube. And in fact, I've now had to hide about 25 of my videos in order to try and avoid getting strikes because, you know, they've now basically shifted the goalposts. Stuff we were talking about last year is now wrong on YouTube. And if you say it, or if you said it back then, you get a strike. That's amazing, isn't it? So they're obviously crooks, Google and YouTube and the Bilderberg Press, just simply taking out channels like UK Column, Anna Breeze, people like that, and myself, just to make sure that you don't know anything about things like ivermectin, and you don't know about the dangers of vaccines, particularly for kids either. You start talking, I was talking about the flu vaccine on YouTube, and YouTube got rid of my video, assuming it was the COVID vaccine. I appealed, saying it's nothing to do with the COVID vaccine, this is about the flu vaccine, and they said, oh, well, actually, we uphold our strike. So there's obviously a media war going on, using YouTube in order to, kill people, basically, to make sure people don't know what to do when they're making decisions about vaccines and about treatments for COVID and where to go. So with ivermectin there, linking the two, Tony Blair's chief junk scientist, Sir David King, is now running Sage. He was the guy who was behind the dash for diesel. He said diesel cars are great. Do you remember? And now he's running Sage as the diesel cars are all being taxed. Also, Rolf Mengele from last week, we didn't have time for that, on his doctor father. What did the notorious Nazi human experimentation doctor tell his son about why he did what he did back in Nazi Germany, experimenting on human beings? And more from Altian Childs, straight in at the top of conspiracy classics charts this week on how Freemasonry could simply be a cloak for all sorts of cults and secret societies, some inside and some outside Freemasonry, but Freemasonry being the main cloak. All bad and some worse than others, including, of course, the ultimate Satanism. That's what Altian Charles is talking about this week in the clip from his conspiracy classic, number 9. But first, Hinkley Point is in the news, or not, as a disaster in an identical plant over in Taishan in China, which spells more disaster for Hinkley C, already beset by multiple black swan events that leave Hinkley C looking both uneconomic and unsafe. We hear from the local experts at the Stop Hinkley campaign. There's also the link between the plant and the virtual destruction of sea life in the Bristol Channel. Oops, environmentalists. So why are some green groups and the official Scottish Green Party still supporting nuclear power? It's killing all the sea life. Not very environmental. Plus, an event on College Green here in Bristol last Sunday where the church leaders came to listen to the travellers and the squatters who were brutally attacked by Avon and Somerset police on Tuesday, the 23rd of March this year. And the Kill the Bill protest, which was entirely peaceful, except for the police, who were not very peaceful at all. In fact, they were criminal. As if the Priti Patel police state bill was already in law. That's how they were behaving. And the heating up, the beating up and the stealing and destruction of property by the police and by Bristol City Council, reminiscent of the 1930s Nazi attacks on gypsies. We hear one woman's testimony from the horrifying evening when she realised the police had been lying to them about being allowed to stay the night, and suddenly at 10 o'clock they appeared, launching a surprise attack on these peaceful protesters in an attempt to scare them into submission. But we'll start with Hinkley, Martin. This accident in China made a little line in the news Wednesday, I think it was, maybe Tuesday possibly, a tiny little we think there might have been a little bit of an accident at this Chinese reactor. Only thing is, it's the same type as Hinkley and it's not working.
Well, I did notice that this week, but I frankly didn't bother to investigate it, because all these stories about everything going wrong in China, I generally think, well, there's a bit of a campaign to say that sort of thing, so I didn't bother to investigate.
Oh, you're a victim of your own propaganda spin.
Well, indeed, but it's also, there's only so
many... Things do go wrong in China,
well,
too,
sure,
you know.
Yeah, but there's only so many hours in the day, and, I didn't bother to investigate too closely.
I mean, I think this is something that we all do to a certain extent, whether we admit it or not. We think, if you know, whichever our party, it's a bit like football, isn't it? When someone says something about a particular football team you support, you think, oh, a load of rubbish if they're saying something negative, and, oh, that's brilliant if they say something positive. Isn't it called groupthink?
Well, you could also just call it confirmation bias. You know, we generally tend to look for information which reinforces what we already know, and that's pretty much true of everybody. But I did notice it, but I didn't bother to look into in any case, I've got no real inside knowledge about what may or may not have happened there.
You see, confirmation bias is not good journalism, is it? This is the thing.
No, but I mean,
we need to be even-handed, don't we?
Well, in theory, that's true, but in practice, we've got to recognise confirmation bias. I think that's probably the more important thing.
As I said at the top of the hour, we'll be talking to Piers Corbyn, and I made a point this time, maybe not so much as the last time I interviewed him a few months ago, of putting to him as many difficult questions as I possibly could. That, what you're doing there, is you're actually getting some real journalism. So I'm putting him, you know, on the spot. But anyway, we didn't have that in Martin's mind with this China story, but it is fascinating to look. First thing I did is I called up the Stop Hinkley people and said, is this a similar type of reactor? They said, it's the same. So here is Roy Pomfrey from Stop Hinkley talking about exactly this Taishan incident, where there's the release of what they call noble gases, which are basically radioactive gas from this reactor, which didn't behave as it was supposed to behave, as predicted and designed over in China. And this is what we can expect here on the Bristol Channel.
This should be EDF's flagship, because this is exactly the same model of a European pressurized water reactor. That's what it's called. And the one at Taishan is the first one they've actually managed to get to work. They started work in Finland and in France before they started work in Taishan. And even though Taishan was delayed, they did manage to get the Chinese manufacturer, builder, constructor, did manage to get Taishan up and working in a surprisingly short time, bearing in mind how they were struggling in Finland and France with exactly the same model reactor, which is exactly what they're putting into Hinkley C. That's why it's of interest, is because the first nuclear power station, the first reactor for a generation being built in the UK, is the same design as one that, after only been running for a couple of years, now seems to be problematic in China. And so there are a number of concerns. Firstly, this is happening in China, and the nuclear regulators in Finland and France and the UK can be taken to be a bit more objective and probably demanding and able to have some effect on what's actually happening. We know the French have thrown out some of the steel that was supposed to be going into the Flamanville, the French reactor, and we assume they'd be similarly assertive here. Over in China, I hesitate to say whether a Chinese nuclear regulator was actually going to be capable of taking on the government-backed building and the construction of a nuclear power station over there. So, what's interesting is that although that's been going for a couple of years, and you would have thought that EDF would be making a great song and dance about the fact that, here, look, we've got one of these to work, I have to say that in the numerous meetings I've attended, EDF's own meetings locally, it's a dog that doesn't bark. They rarely, if ever, mention the fact that they've got one to work in China. They don't really want to talk about it. And now we get an indication of why that might be the case. In fact, it's not all going swimmingly in China after all.
As I understand it, part of the deal to switch this reactor on, if it ever gets finished, is that it's got to be shown to be working safely for a period of time elsewhere. Maybe that's in Finland or France or
it's
China.
Yeah.
Is that? Oh, okay. So it's the French one. So the French one's got to be switched on.
Yes.
It's got to be working correctly with with no problems before the one at Hinkley is allowed to be switched on. So how close are they to switching the French one on even?
The last information we had was next year, but they have kept putting back that start date for quite a while, for years. And there's also concern that because of the problems with the steel, that they can only run it for a couple of years before they have to stop, slow it all, take it all, and then take it apart and put new steel in. And that doesn't make any sense at all, because it's extremely costly, dangerous and time consuming. So I don't know. But the thing about Hinkley C is that and the reason we believe that EDF are throwing extra people at it desperately is because that has to be up and running by 2029, or that very generous deal that I've just referred to, that falls and something else happens. The government has at least got a deadline date, which we believe is 2029, as for what happens here. And that's as far as I understand it, that's the thing. There were some loans which EDF didn't take up, which were conditional on Flamanville running by last year, the French reactor running by last year, which it clearly wasn't. So it was very sensible of EDF not to make the government loans that they might have had to help them build Hinkley C, not to take those up, because they would have struggled with dealing with them because of the French plant not working.
So, just checking the news feeds here, Martin, there's no reference in the British news at all to the fact that this is highly likely to affect Hinkley C.
Well, you can imagine, it's, as you know, news agendas get dominated by what's happening in that week. And, you know, nuclear power, although we follow it fairly closely here, and obviously the people, campaigners in Hinkley are following it closely, lots of other people are more worried about the England-Scotland game.
Well, yes, we're definitely competing with that. But then, of course, this is the sort of stuff that they love to churn out. It's everyone following the football rather than the fact that we may have a load of jobs go in Hinkley, and all the billions that have been spent on it already is a complete waste of money. But anyway, that's why we're here. We don't do sport. We do journalism here. Another thing, just quickly this week, Hinkley C, a fire has been confirmed at the plant after a smoke cloud was seen from Burnham-on-Sea. So tourists with their binoculars at Burnham-on-Sea noticed a whole load of smoke billowing out from the construction site, Martin. We didn't get a press release from EDF saying, I'm sorry, we've had a fire down here. It's basically the locals with their binoculars that are making the news nowadays.
Well, obviously, I mean, if they're having problems with it, as they clearly are, and, you know, as we've discussed on previous shows, the economics of it just don't add up, then the less said the better from the point of view of EDF and the consortium that are building it.
Well, Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue attended the plant this week after one of the galleries, which is used to run pipes and cables around the station, caught light. Well, that means, of course, all those pipes and cables will have to be replaced. That may set things back another 6 months or something.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you may be right. I do not know. I mean, obviously, the fundamentals here are that nuclear power, to my mind, has never been economically viable. And the only reason why the consortium that are building it agreed to build it was on the understanding that they would get a guaranteed price for the energy, which is far higher than the current market price. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it. And, of course, it may well be that if they run out of time in the building process, then they won't get that market price and the whole thing will just be a waste of money,
well,
if nothing else.
I'm reminded of an insurance loss assessor I got as a contact years ago. This is in the mid-1990s, as I was doing my sort of jollying around Ireland in the south. And this was, I think, on the way to Cork, actually. He was an insurance loss assessor at Three Mile Island in the States. And it is a similar sort of thing that happened that caused the reactor to melt down in Three Mile Island, was a problem with the pipes and the cables in one of the galleries at that station. It was the gallery connecting the control room to the reactor itself. And what had happened was the pressure had been evacuated from this pipe in order to make sure that there was no fire could take place. The only problem was that the valve failed, and it had failed for a while. No one was checking the valve. And then when there was a small electrical fire, it took off with whole loads of oxygen in there. And it just burnt. And so it got rid of the ability of the people who were running that station to actually to slow the reactor down when it started getting hotter. So it just started getting hotter and hotter and hotter and melted down. Of course, at that point, all the staff jump in their cars, helicopters, etc., and do a runner, because there's nothing you can do. So we've got a similar sort of system also is going on with the hacking of the plants, the reactors in Iran, where actually this is not happening through a fire accident, but it's being done deliberately using something like the Stuxnet virus.
Yeah, and I'm also reminded of what happened at Chernobyl and Fukushima. You know, I mean, all of these things are straws in the wind, as I say. I mean, the Chinese and the French committed to producing energy through nuclear power years ago, and the Japanese, for similar reasons, because they don't want to be dependent on oil. They haven't got a lot of oil. And, you know, if you might be able to buy oil in the world market at certain prices. But of course, if there's any, a war or something like that, then you won't be able to.
So, in other words,
the decision to make nuclear power has some strategic.
The Middle East. Well, okay, the Middle East is where the oil comes from. So if there's a war in the Middle East, which seems to be being cooked up all the time, then it makes sense to have renewable wind power and probably nuclear, because you're not going to have any oil anymore.
That's right. So the decision about nuclear power, in ostensibly it really doesn't add up. I mean, that's one of the things that's killed it off, basically.
You mean the green because it's been said it's carbon neutral.
Well, yeah, well, that's just...
Although it's not.
Well, I mean, yeah, to build a nuclear power station is not carbon neutral, is it? You're using masses of concrete, petrol, you know, etc. So, in a sense, that's a bit of a red herring. In other words, that's a kind of justification for what you want to do anyway. But countries like China and Japan and France have gone for nuclear power for strategic reasons, which is because it doesn't really add up economically as things stand. But of course, once you've committed yourself to building them, and you know, there are plenty of functional nuclear power stations in China and in France, and as long as they're not losing too much money, you keep them running you've invested so much.
I mean, I remember Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, well, actually, we're not going to do HS2, even though, of course, they're now committed to doing it. And these politicians do tend to change their minds. But he was saying, well, it doesn't matter that we've already spent money on it, because we need to just pull the plug now. Otherwise, we'll be spending loads more money on it and wasting that money. Anyway, you're absolutely right about the dubiousness of the environmental credentials of something like Hinkley, and I spoke to Alan Jeffrey last week about this, and this is where about because there are increasingly these groups out there which are part of the UK and Welsh Green Party, which are very pro-nuclear. They argue that we must do nuclear, and we must do it now. They say it's a zero-carbon source of energy. But more worryingly, the Scottish Green Party, which is more power in the Scottish Parliament, certainly than the English and Welsh Green Party have in the Welsh Parliament or in Westminster, they are actually now pro-nuclear, officially pro-nuclear, because they're saying that the reactors, I think there's a couple of them in Scotland, Martin, need to be extended. The life of them needs to be extended. So they're effectively now pro-nuclear, the Greens in Scotland.
Well, you could argue, once you've built something like a nuclear power station and you've spent a load of money, I'm thinking they're talking about Torness, which I went to protest against in the 1970s. But once you've built it, the same would be true in Russia, because you've got various nuclear power stations which are already up and running. Now, even if you want to get rid of nuclear power, it doesn't make economic sense to close them all down straight away, because you basically, what you do is you run them until they come to the end of their natural life, because you've put a load of fixed cost into it. And you might as well carry on using them until they've got to be replaced.
Well,
the
Germans didn't do that. They just halted their program when Fukushima happened, didn't they? Whole thing.
They did, because it's partly a political decision. And, of course, the Greens look as if they're going to be the largest party in the September's general election.
Well, it was also
Germany.
The biggest protest movement in Germany was the massive, massive anti-nuclear movement, which would shut down railway lines, transporting nuclear waste.
In other words, the balance of, you know, because it's not just an economic decision, it's also a military decision and a political decision. In Germany, the Greens have basically killed off further nuclear developments in Germany, much to the disgust of the industrialists.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Alan Jeffrey now talking about this very issue of just how green nuclear really is.
Nuclear is very carbon intensive. Now, despite what the nuclear industry tries to make out, they are in a desperate situation to try and keep governments building nuclear power stations for their businesses, their engineering and government, never-ending government costs. The point is, no method of generation of electricity is zero. The only time when nuclear becomes a non-carbon producing was in the fission in the actual reactor itself. But every other part of the nuclear cycle is highly carbon intensive. From the mining, of course, thousands of tons of rock are mined to get a tiny amount of uranium out, using, of course, lots of fossil fuels. They pollute lots of the indigenous populations as they process the rocks to get and make the fuel, the yellow cake. When it comes over here, there's more fossil fuels used in the processing to manufacture the fuel and to concentrate the fuel. Transporting across the world. And remember, if nuclear needs a constant supply of fuel, like uranium mining goes through the whole life of the reactor. Whereas if you think of wind power once you've built the wind turbines or solar, once you produce them, there is no carbon dioxide production once they've been built and made. The building of the nuclear power stations takes masses and masses of carbon, produces lots and lots of carbon dioxide. Hinkley Point, they've been boasting about the amount of largest amounts of concrete mixes. And it takes years and years to build it with concrete and steel, which does not help climate change. Because all those years it takes, and it takes decades to build a nuclear power station, they are burning fossil fuels, making the concrete, making the steel. And this takes for many, many years when you are not actually helping climate change. You're actually putting more and more carbon dioxide into the air. And what happens to the waste afterwards? When a power station comes to the end of its life, then you have masses more carbon dioxide produced as you dismantle the power stations, transport the fuel up to perhaps Sellafield, and then you've got thousands of years of looking after this high-level toxic radioactive waste. And nobody at the moment really knows what to do with that waste. We've had 60 years when all they've said is, oh, we know what to do. We'll just bury it under the ground, under this, just like Finland. Well, Finland has spent 20 years trying to do 26 kilometers of tunnels through igneous rocks, because it's got two reactors with fuel there. No other country in the world has got as far, far as that, but it's taken sort of 20 odd years to get that far. And they're only just giving them permission, to try and start to build the end of those tunnels now to put the radioactive waste. So you imagine all the carbon dioxide produced in the tunneling of that. And we don't even know where we're going to put all the radioactive waste that's built up over the last 60 years. And we don't know how much it's going to be, because we don't know how many nuclear power stations. It's going to be less now, because the commercial financial world is not interested now in nuclear power stations. And they're much more interested in the renewables, which are cheaper, quicker to produce, and don't produce the long-term radioactive waste, which our children are going to be left with to try and deal with the problems that we haven't solved ourselves, a technical and a huge financial black hole, which will have to come out of taxpayers. We used our taxpayers' money to build our nuclear power stations. We sold them off, some of the newer ones off cheaply to France. And now it's regretting, because in the next 3 years, six of those reactors they bought, they hope to sort of extend the lives by another 10 years. They're giving up on now. Six of the old British reactors won't be here in 3 years' time. They've actually started just this week. They've said that the Dungeness power stations, which have been offline for the last 2 years through technical problems and corrosion problems, they haven't produced any electricity for the last 2 years, along with Hunterston and Hinkley Point B, of course. All those reactors with their cracking problems have been offline from at least a year each, not producing any electricity, and certainly therefore not reducing the amount of coal.
Well, it sounds from what Alan Jeffries is saying there, Martin, first of all, that these things are most definitely not green. They are absolutely incredibly destructive to the environment. But secondly, also, the whole industry is beset by massive problems. It's almost as if they'd have just carried on building the 1950s style reactors, like the old Magnox reactors, they'd probably been fine. But they're obsessed with new technologies. Oh, it's all going to be loads better. Of course, it costs something like 20 times more than one of those original ones. And it's always beset with problems.
Well, the whole decision to make nuclear power in the first place was simply, they were producing loads of radioactive waste from producing nuclear weapons, and they thought, well, let's do something with it if we're going to have it. So the economics of nuclear power are clearly bonkers. I mean, in the 1980s, the Thatcher government wanted to privatise the nuclear industry here, and I wrote a paper for the New Economics Foundation about it, and the City of London took one look at the books and said, we're not touching that with a barge pole. So the only reason why you have nuclear power is basically because of political...
It's a lobby, isn't it? It's the lobby, a bit like the big pharma. There's also a nuclear lobby, which makes sure it gets the decisions it wants and contracts get signed.
Don't forget that nuclear lobby is also locked into the nuclear weapons industry, so the can-do reactors...
Yeah, but I mean, do we need any more plutonium, really?
No, we don't. But, I mean, I'm just going to make the point that in the 1970s, the Canadians supplied the Indians with the can-do, you know, Canadian nuclear power reactors, and it was the base, you know, it was the nuclear waste from those reactors that allowed India to develop nuclear weapons. So the decision to have nuclear power is often a strategic decision to do with having access to nuclear weapons, which, of course, is one of the reasons why you've got all this fuss about the Iranians.
Well, the other thing is that these old power stations like the Magnox ones and Hinkley B, they have cooling pools where when the fuel rods come out of the reactor, they go and sit in a cooling pond in a flask. I think they stick them in a transport flask and then stick them in a pool of water. And it takes them a year to cool down. So at which point, after they've cooled down for a year, then they can be transported up to be reprocessed, as they call it, have the plutonium extracted from them up at Sellafield. Now, this new plant, apparently, it's going to have to be at least 20 years that the waste is going to stay on site at Hinkley, slowly cooling down in air. They're not going to put them in water. They're going to cool it in air. That is if this thing even gets off the ground. But before we get completely off the politics of all this, Martin, is it feasible, do you think, that the Chinese reactor was sabotaged? I mean, we've got this massive, it's an economic war, it's a very hostile reaction from the US and its allies to China at the moment.
Well, I've got no evidence to suggest that. I mean, as you know, nuclear power is extremely iffy in its own right anyway. And therefore, I mean, certainly what happened in Iran, the attacks on their reactor are being carried out by cyber attacks, and the Israelis and the Americans have openly boasted that they did it. And of course, there's some evidence to suggest that the Stuxnet virus, which was responsible for taking down the Iranian reactor at Bushehr, was also, it leaked out onto the internet and then played a role in Fukushima. I mean, how stupid. I mean, and of course, if you take down somebody's nuclear power station.
Just a second. Fukushima was a tsunami. It wasn't a virus.
No, but apparently the Stuxnet virus is a designed virus to mess up nuclear power stations.
So coincidentally, just the same day as there was a tsunami,
because it was just weakening the systems at Fukushima. That's what the suggestion is that I've read, and that's just rumour. I haven't got any evidence to back that up. But, I mean, in any case, it's pretty irresponsible to go around developing computer viruses which can take down nuclear power. But, I mean, that has always been the argument against nuclear power by Greens in the first place, is that terrorists can easily, whether you like it or not, either get access to the nuclear material or by using computers or other methods sabotage them.
Well, that's right. And in fact, in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page with Roy Pomfrey, and I'll put both of these interviews, the full length versions of them with Alan Jeffrey and Roy Pomfrey, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He says that nowadays they have to design these nuclear reactors with massive loads of concrete around them so that even if someone flies an airliner into it, it will stand the impact of an airliner. Well, of course, that's all very well, but it's even more likely.
It's not going to stand a missile, is it?
Yeah, a missile. It's more likely the thing to hit a nuclear power station than an airliner, let me suggest. And in fact, of course, these things will be targets because, of course, it will cause massive disruption in a country. It's a bit like these American air bases, Martin. Why have we got these things? They all just seem to me to be targets for in any kind of conflict. These places will be targets, and they will cause absolute mayhem in the region where they're based.
Well, not that long ago, there was a missile that was fired. I think it was from the Sinai, I think, and it didn't hit the Dimona nuclear reactor
in Israel,
but it was a shot over the bows for the Israelis, which is, don't forget, we could You know, so say the Iranians, for example, will certainly have the capability to hit the Dimona nuclear reactor. So they don't really need nuclear weapons to deter the Israelis. They could just fire a conventional missile at the Dimona nuclear reactor and blow it up, and they've got themselves a nuclear explosion.
Well, there's also the issue of regulation of these nuclear sites, and Alan is there. I say, I think it was Roy, wasn't it? Was saying that he thinks that the in the West the regulation of these reactors is a bit more robust, and also the press scrutiny. Although we've seen very little of the implications of this China accident for Hinkley, the press is much better over here at actually reporting it when there's a disaster, and it just doesn't happen over in China.
Well, apart from the fact that we do know about what this
yeah, because of the French. This is another point, is that the French company Framatome, which Roy talks about in another part of that interview, this company was the one that blew the whistle. So this is not just the Americans saying it. It's also the French partners with the Chinese at this plant over in China that have blown the whistle. So there's that's another indication that there really is something to see here rather than just being US propaganda. It's a pity, isn't it, that every time we see something which is anti-China, we do, as you quite rightly pointed out, you think to yourself, oh, this is just more American propaganda. This is how important the press is in actually understanding what's going on in our world and what's happening down at Hinkley C. So let's have a listen now to the second part of the interview with Alan Jeffrey, where he talks about something called it's a very important thing, which is part of this new Hinkley C project, which is being built at the moment, and it's called the AFD. Do you know what that is?
Alternative for Deutschland.
No. Acoustic Fish Deterrent. And this is a little, it's an underwater loudspeaker system which bleeps and makes bad noises that fish don't like, that make the fish swim in the wrong away, basically, because there's a whole sucking sound as millions of tons of water is dragged into this power station once it all starts up. So the acoustic fish deterrent is absolutely key in order to stop all these fish dying in the Bristol Channel. The only thing is that the company building at EDF are now trying to say, well, actually, we don't really want to build this acoustic fish deterrent because the fish can't really swim quick enough in order to get away from the sucking of the water. So let's have a listen now to Alan Jeffrey. It's farcical to think that this thing is in the least bit environmental when, I mean, even me talking to anglers along the Bristol Channel anecdotally is saying that where have all the fish gone? The last 20, 30 years, all the fish have disappeared around here. Let's hear it from the lips of Stop Hinkley's Alan Jeffrey now.
The cooling system that they wanted to put in to build Hinkley C is direct cooling, where they take in vast amounts of water from the Bristol Channel and the Severn Estuary to condense the steam, which it's the steam generating reactors only produce heat.
And okay, so how much water do they take, and how far out in the sea?
Right, because of the very very high tides in the Severn Estuary, they have to go out they need four times the amount of cooling water that, say, the B station used. So to get 132 cubic metres per second, they've had to go out to the deeper waters 3 kilometres out into the Bristol Channel, whereas the B station just had 100 yards out it used to collect its water from. So they're going out 3 kilometres, and, of course, with the high tides, the young fish, when the tides go out closer to where these intake tunnels are. And that vast amount of water sucks in like a giant plug hole continuously, and it's going to be sucking in the cooling water vast amounts over 60 years. And they reckon the conservationists reckon it's about 500,000 fish a day will be sucked into the power station. Most of them will not survive. And if you take that over the 60-year life, you're talking about 11 billion fish.
Well, couldn't they just have, say, a grill that the fish couldn't go through?
What happens is that there's four intake tunnel sections on the bed of the River Severn, 3 kilometres out. They drop down 30 kilometres and come down three kilometres back to the power station, where they hit a mesh. That mesh is a revolving cycle so that the water goes through five millimeter spaces. So any eggs or larvae or anything smaller than 5 millimeters just goes straight in and is killed in the hot temperatures in the condensers. The others, once they've hit that mesh, they are very slowly carried up and they're supposed to be dropped off into another channel, which takes them another kilometer back out to sea. So a lot of these fish being dragged and sucked with the pressure changes, the physical damage as they've been forced along these sucked along these pipes, hitting the mesh and then being exposed to the air, most of them will die. I mean, even EDF admit that the herrings and sprats, 90% of them will die in the process, even though they say they've got a fish recovery system.
Well, I mean, surely they could be having a kind of a fish processing plant there as well. Maybe if there's some herring or whatever, that they could just process that and sell it.
Well, if you think back to what happened with the bee station, all this fish was each week they were taking away tons of dead fish, which they went to the local dump and dumped it all. So that was fish of all many types. There's 110 different species of fish that are, some are resident, some are and there's lots of important migratory fish that all go through the Bristol Channel up the Severn Estuary. Processing, these are future stocks of fish we're talking about here. The Severn Estuary is a breeding ground of young fish, and those young fish will grow into older fish as long as they can survive. But if they're killed when they're eggs, larvae, or as young, immature fish, then they won't be breeding in the future. So we're talking about killing off lots of future generations of fish. Normally, there's the ecological balance in the food chains, but this is an extra devastating problem because man is sucking out continuously the marine life out of the Severn Estuary and killing it, and then throwing the dead fish or the wounded fish, which become prey again very easily for other fish. So stocks of fish over 60 years, it will have a devastating effect, especially on some of those fish which are in very low numbers at the moment.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, Alan, I've spoken to fishermen on both sides, basically the Newport side and the Minehead side, and they say that the fish stocks are very depleted and you will find very few people actually out there, fishermen and fisherwomen, if there are such things, that they were saying that this was, they were always very, very dissatisfied with the number of fish they're catching nowadays.
Well, this has been going on because you've had the A station and the B station, don't forget, for the last 30 years. And all the local traditional fishermen, like the sled fishermen, not far from Hinkley Point, at Stalford, they've said how all their catches have gone down 90% ever since they've had the B station, the A and the B station there, sort of thing. And they've virtually gone out of business, the traditional fishermen of the areas. And as you say, fish stocks have been going down. John May, who's been a lifelong angler on the Bristol Channel, the Severn Estuary, he is very unhappy with the amounts of young, immature fish, which are just no longer about. Many years ago, there were masses of young, immature fish that bred in the Severn Estuary. But because of the nuclear power stations dragging out all this cooling water and these direct cooling systems, when there are alternatives around the world, in some places, direct cooling is banned in a lot of America, because of the damage to the fish stocks. The alternatives, of course, are cooling towers. So you can condense your water back again in the steam generation system with much less damaging ways all over the world. In America and over Europe, you quite often see the great big cooling towers. But for some reason, our government and EDF wanted to use direct cooling. by sucking in vast amounts of water from the Severn Estuary. And the Environment Agency were very concerned about this, because in 2013, when they were trying to get their planning permission to build, they had to pass an environmental impact assessment. And the Environment Agency said, your cooling system is going to have a terrible effect on the fish stocks and the marine life in the Severn Estuary. You have to use some mitigation. And they agreed in 2013 to have an acoustic fish deterrent. What that basically means is a series of loudspeakers that will send out noise so that fish, and 90% of the fish that can hear, will be put off with that noise, and they wouldn't go anywhere near where they're to be sucked in into the cooling system on the intake heads. And they agreed to that in 2013 to get their planning permission to start the building. 7 years later, EDF suddenly decide, oh, we can't afford to do it, and it's a health and safety risk. Now, this is very suspicious indeed. When they're to get their planning permission, they're trying to avoid what they were asked to do by the Environment Agency. And now what they're saying is, oh, we've got some scientists who say, oh, it won't be that. They've reduced the numbers of fish that they originally said was going to, were going to be killed, even with the AFD. And now they say, oh, well, without the AFD, it's not really going to make much difference. They don't seem to care about trying to protect the fish species entering and being gradually reduced over many years. It's certainly not a good sign for the biodiversity of the ecology of the marine life in the Severn Estuary.
Alan Jeffrey from Stop Hinkley. Martin, I think, you know, the maybe month-old piles of dead fish should be thrown at the Greens that think that nuclear is green.
Well, it's not green, and it's not really economical. The reasons for having nuclear power are largely political and military, and people need to recognise that. Although I think you've also got to recognise...
Well, it's just a powerful lobby, surely. That's all it is.
Well, it is
a powerful lobby.
It's not just
and they're just doing what they want.
It's not just a powerful lobby. The nuclear industry is a powerful lobby, of course it is, but don't forget states will make decisions to have nuclear energy because they want nuclear weapons. And that's nothing to do with whether nuclear power pays or not, or whether it's ecological.
100 different species of fish, 500,000 fish a day sucked into this thing, and now they just don't want to bother with it. They're saying, oh, we don't need any acoustic fish deterrent. That was just a load of rubbish that we came out with in order to get our planning permission. We never intended to do it anyway.
Well, as you pointed out before, what may well happen with this is it simply goes bankrupt. People have all been paid the money to pretend to build it, and they're all happy, and the company's concerned go bankrupt, and everybody walks away and says, what was that all about?
Well, last year we had Dr. Chris Busby on this show saying that he thinks that actually big projects like this aren't about achieving anything and building anything. They're just about the money that goes into people's pockets before the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, I mean, Keynes in the 1930s talked about the whole idea of digging holes to fill them with bottles with £10 notes in, and then burying them and having other people coming and digging them up, because that keeps the economy pump primed. So in a sense, you know, infrastructure spending, especially if it doesn't succeed and you don't end up killing all the fish, you just spent a load of money, which then, you know, keeps everybody on the payroll for the money perfectly happy.
And isn't it interesting how what you were saying there about the cooling towers? Well, if you have a couple of cooling towers at Hinkley Sea instead of this massive amount of water that you're continually taking in and spewing back out into the Bristol Channel, then you don't need to take anywhere near as much water. That you, all you do is the water cools down in the cooling towers. But, of course, that might be considered, oh, well, it's actually a physical eyesore and we don't really want to look at it here. That's probably the reason I would have thought, well, we're not building cooling towers, is because they will have all sorts of trouble with planning, because it doesn't look very nice right next to the Quantux, the site of special scientific interest.
Well, that may well be so.
Outstanding natural beauty.
Indeed.
With cooling towers.
So you can have no cooling towers and no fish, or cooling towers and fish.
Anyway, Roy
or maybe neither.
Roy Pomfrey and gosh, who was that I just spoke to then? Anyway, both of them will be on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Full report there on the what seems to me increasingly likely demise of the great flagship nuclear power station being built in Britain right now, with something like 4,000 people working every day on something that might maybe never happen at all. Ultimately, Martin, what do you think is going to happen to the nuclear power industry? And you know, you did this report for the New Economics Foundation years ago. Did you see this potential grinding to a halt finally happening?
Yeah. I mean, we're already spending quite a large proportion of taxpayers' money. I think it's 2p in the pound on income tax, something like that, to look after our existing nuclear waste pile. So you can see that the nuclear industry and the nuclear weapons industry is going to be a big black hole eating up resources for generations to come. And at a certain point, one of the things that may happen, of course, if you have a big crash in the mainstream economy, is that these projects really just become non-viable. And they may be non-viable even if the economy doesn't crash. So the most likely outcome is that it will gradually be run down. You know, countries which have already committed to having nuclear power stations, they've got them up and running, they will carry on running them because there's no point just closing them down for the hell of it. But when they come to the end of their life, I think it's quite likely the nuclear industry will die a long and prolonged death, just like the rest of the planet, I suppose.
Okay, we're going to go and look at some local stories now. And before we have our main one, which is about the police action, bullying, threatening, beating up action against the squatters and the travellers, really preempting this whole Priti Patel police state bill back on the Tuesday, the 23rd of March this year. In Bristol City Council, Martin, the councillors are raising fears about a big revamp of the health and care services. What is a white paper? I didn't realise that local authorities brought these out, but apparently they do. A new health and care bill is going to force providers to work closer together and to scrap competition. Well, is that a good idea? I thought the whole reason we were farming these services out was because the prices came down because of competition. Isolated elderly residents could fall through the cracks, says the Bristol Post, of a major revamp of how health and social care is commissioned in the region. Councillors fear South Gloucestershire's Council Health Scrutiny Committee members raised concerns about the government's white paper for a new health and care bill, including worries it would result in a cost-cutting exercise. A health chief said the wide-ranging reforms would improve services by requiring closer cooperation among providers, the NHS and local authorities, where the legislation would also scrap the mandate for all health service contracts to be put out to competitive tender. So we're just going to dish them out to who we want rather than put them out to tender.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is to do with the Jeremy Hunt's reforms, if you remember, when Cameron was running to be Prime Minister. He basically said, read my lips, no top-down reform of the health service, and people voted Tory on the understanding that the health service was going to carry on as it, in its marketised form, was going to carry on. And then they immediately brought in the whole thing of creating, you know, GP practices were going to be contracting out, and they were going to be contracting services out and so on. And of course, what's happened with Hancock in charge now is they've suddenly decided that they've seen the light, glory be, and we should go back to having a planned system in which competition is reduced. Now, of course, since they introduced the competition in the first place, this is a pretty rich. But of course, what used to happen in Bristol and elsewhere is that things like old people's homes were run by local authorities.
We're also looking at this thing with Marvin Rees in a minute. The mayor's been on TV, Marvin Rees, apparently a very overwhelmingly positive feedback after the Statue Wars documentary. I actually watched about half an hour of it this week. Definitely, you know, it's a very professional propaganda job about how wonderful our glorious Mayor Marvin Rees is and, you know, magnanimous, etc. It's got Kevin Slocum, who's basically runs him. He's his Alasdair Campbell on that programme too. And it's got his wife on, his American wife. But the main thing is here, it says it's overwhelmingly positive feedback. Well, I and various other people over the last 2 weeks have been blocked from commenting on the social media posts around this program, Martin. So various people have been moaning, including me, saying, oh, that's interesting, suddenly I can't post on the Bristol Mayor's Facebook pages anymore.
Well, that's an obvious strategy to pursue if you want overwhelmingly positive response.
It's not overwhelmingly positive feedback if the people who are quite reasonably good at understanding how what you're really up to in terms of PR and criticising are blocked. So that's not positive feedback at all, is it, really?
It's no, just so made to look like positive feedback. You can spin it as that, though, can't you?
Anyway, thankfully, the people at the Bristol Post have put it all in big inverted commas. So they're obviously making sure that people realise what's going on. Anyway, we're going to hear now from the Travellers on College Green on Sunday. There was an event in Bristol where the church leaders came to listen to Travellers and Squatters who were brutally attacked by Avon and Somerset police on Tuesday the 23rd of March at 10 p.m. in the evening. They were doing a peaceful protest and the police tricked them deliberately by saying it's okay, you can stay the night and everything and everything's going to be cool. But at 10 p.m. 150 riot police zoomed around the corner with bright lights and megaphones and said, you've got to move now. I mean, this is Martin, before we hear this clip, this is a little bit like these 1930 Nazi attacks on gypsies, actually. They were deliberately tricked and then beaten up.
Well, it's certainly unacceptable, and it certainly shows the direction of travel of Priti Patel's police bill.
I call it police not state bill.
Do police state bill, yes, I think that's fair enough. I think comparisons with Nazi Germany may sound overdone.
Okay, 1930s. I mean, this is how it started, isn't it?
It is how it started. But on the other hand, I mean, lots of gypsies ended up in concentration camps. I don't think anybody's ended up in a concentration camp here.
Well, we're
they?
Talking about earlier than that, really. I mean, there was persecution of minorities, trade unionists, communists, etc.
Indeed.
As well as gypsies, Jews, Slavs, etc.
Well,
in the beginning.
Well, I know, but at the same time, you've got to be careful
about
rhetoric.
And that was Nazi Germany in the mid-1930s, yes. Was run by the Nazis.
Yes, it was, and the lots of things are wrong with what's going on in this country now. I don't disagree.
I don't think they were put into gas chambers, but then that was later on, wasn't it? And I think that's why I'm saying this, is because it definitely was Nazi Germany, and I think it's an indication of what may be to come. But anyway, let's have a listen to the testimony of one of those travellers now.
As they enclosed, everyone put their hands up and chanted, "This is a peaceful protest." People were sat on the ground with their hands up, chanting peaceful protest. The police picked up a girl sat in front of me and threw her into myself and other protesters as they enclosed. Everyone's belongings were laid on the floor as they trampled through the crowd. They threw a bike onto us. The protesters tried to move back whilst police tried to pull protesters apart. And when that didn't work, they kicked us repeatedly and walked on them as they were sat. They were using their shields to push people as they were sat peacefully with their hands up in the air. Through this very violent manoeuvre from the police, I didn't see one person respond violently back. People were hurt, crying and screaming, and still had their hands raised, chanting peaceful protest. All violence witnessed was from the police. Once the police had trampled over us with their boots and shields, they pushed everyone to Dean Lane. This left a few people on the green. The protesters that were left on College Green tried to pick up the litter and belongings that had been left behind, but police wouldn't let us continue. During this time, I made a pile of everyone's belongings for people to easily collect. There were lots of valuables left. They then created a new line and stopped everyone litter picking. Instead, they tore down the tents and trampled over everything. Protesters calmly asked if they could clear the things left on the green and agreed to go once they had done that, as they didn't want any violence. But the police continued to not let them. The police pushed a girl to the floor with no provocation and kettled the remaining people left into a tight circle with no exit out. A group of people, around 12 people, were left on the green, surrounded by 50 police in riot gear, who didn't leave an exit for the protesters to disperse from. I saw outside the circle. Two officers pinned a girl to the floor while a third beat her. Officers forced people down Deanery Lane, shouting, "Force will be used," while people who were trying to leave were being beaten. One girl was filmed while walking backwards and police beat her. No protesters resisted. This violence came directly from the police. I only saw people shouting back to them to stop beating their friends. There was not a single person using force back, and the police hit us all like we had severely hurt them. Throughout the time the riot police were there, everyone was outnumbered completely, with at least 3-1 riot police. The fear I experienced that night, sat with my hands in the air, with no protective gear, whilst the riot police came forward with batons and shields, hitting and battering anyone in their line. That's a fear I will not forget for a long time.
So there you've got testimony from one of those people who were amongst 100 or hundreds or so travellers and squatters who were protesting outside, peacefully outside, and they'd got permission from the police to do it. And yet the police then came around the corner and, well, as you heard there, their possessions were taken. Some of them disappeared. I've heard musical instruments that were never returned. And things like tents. The tents were returned, but with all the poles snapped in half deliberately. This is really just a targeting, a hate campaign by the council and the police, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think this was after the so-called riot at the police station, was it not?
Yeah, it was so, about a week and a half, 2 weeks after.
Yeah, so yeah. You, what you've got is action, reaction, counter-reaction. You know,
so the police are just taking it out on these people, even though they're peaceful.
Yeah, well, that's right, but they're taking it out on this peaceful demonstration because there wasn't a lot they could do when they were outnumbered the previous week around the police station.
Basic question that someone needs to ask the police. I mean, I'd love to ask Andy Marsh before he disappears, and maybe this disgusting action of the police is one of the reasons he's off, although it might also be the failure to prosecute Lloyds Bank with some of his detectives in bed with Lloyds Bank, who really should be being prosecuted, what is the point of protesting peacefully if the police are going to behave like this?
Well, this is going to be...
They're actually asking for violent protests, really, aren't they?
Well, yes, because in many ways that suits the book of the Priti Patel, certainly, and the government. They are trying to win swing voters in marginal constituencies who don't care about travellers and so on. The pictures on the TV of police beating up people is not necessarily going to lose them any votes. Especially after they'd had pictures the previous week of people throwing rocks at the police.
Isn't it also to do with the massive majority that Boris has got, and he's thinking, well, I can pretty much do anything for the next few years, and by the time it comes to the next election, and even the local elections here in Bristol, everyone would have forgotten about this.
Well, yes, but there's also Priti Patel has got a policy of trying to provoke demonstrations and protests against her so that she can then, play the hard woman of sending in the boot boys, and that's actually the strategy, although it seems to have come somewhat unstuck in Amersham and Chesham on Thursday when the Tories lost their majority and were overwhelmingly defeated.
Well, that was what do you put that down to?
Largely down to the policy of the government of ripping up the planning laws and just saying that anybody can build a bovis home anywhere, which is basically red rag to a bull to your average homeowner in Berkshire.
And also HS2 apparently is going near there. So this is another thing they're really, people are just completely peeved with. So I suppose the Lib Dems are just going, hey guys, we're not nasty like that, even though actually they support HS2 on a national level.
The HS2 only clips the edge of the constituency, so it doesn't affect the vast majority directly. But certainly the idea that they're going to build loads and loads of kind of, crummy housing right next door to my mansion is obviously going to be
it's not just crummy housing. We've seen these estates popping up all over the place. I mean, you and I remember, houses being built in the 70s and the 90s, etc. The houses that they're building now are not only right on top of each other, but they look like kind of little Lego houses with tiny rooms with mirrors in to try and make the rooms look bigger and no gardens. So these houses are actually some of the worst that have ever been built in this country.
That's right. And of course, the high prices. The developers are sort of major funders of the Conservative Party. Saw what happened with Robert Jenks.
Another lobby
in East London, where he said, "Well, you don't want Hackney Council to have loads of money, so give me planning permission so that I don't have to pay £40 million surcharge to Hackney Council for these Marxists to do whatever they want to do with the money." And of course, that's what they did. And then he gave the Tory Party a big lump sum as a thank you. So the Tories the Tory government are caught between their funders, the housing developers, and their voters, who do not want loads of, you know, what they regard as substandard housing on their patch.
On this attack on the 23rd of March, actually, no, this is a different protest on the 18th of June. That would have been the one beforehand that the police are, you know, with the attack on Bridewell Police Station. So this is a 23-year-old, formerly of Werrington in Staffordshire, but now of no fixed abode, entered a not guilty plea to a charge that he failed to disperse from College Green. Oh, it is the 23rd of March, sorry. On the 23rd of March, contrary to health protection coronavirus restrictions regulations. So this is the incredible thing with the police, is they're now using the COVID laws in order to say that, oh, well, we only came as riot cops to disperse you because of the COVID laws, even though their police liaison people have been saying to the people all afternoon and all evening up until 10 p.m. now, it's okay, it's fine, you can stay here, no problem.
I think the big problem for Bristol Police in relation to this incident is that they'd negotiated with the organisers, and the organisers had, as far as they were concerned, come to an agreement with the police about what was and what wasn't acceptable. And then the police went back on that. That, I think, will come back to haunt them, where, because obviously what will happen in future is people won't feel that they're negotiating in good faith. So that will cause problems for them further down the line.
And so in a brief hearing, District Judge Lynn Matthews has adjourned the case now until the 2nd of July. Kingston was allowed unconditional bail to attend court on that date. Well, I suppose this is what the Tory establishment love, isn't it, to see prosecutions of homeless people?
Well, I mean, from the point of view of the travellers, obviously what happened on the night itself was extremely upsetting and so on. But if you go and have your day in court, it gives you a chance to make your case. And if it's reported properly in the local press, then, there's no such thing as bad publicity, is there?
Well, Jeff Bennett has done a good job on reporting this, making sure that the various aspects of this are there. But, you know, it does seem absolutely incredible that the police, well, I suppose the police are in the situation where, you haven't prosecuted anybody for that massive attack on those 150 or so travellers and squatters. What did you do it for in the first place? And so they have got to come up with a sort of token gesture prosecution. And so they've managed to find this homeless guy to prosecute.
Yes, it reminds me of the so-called petrol bombs at Telegraph Heights all those years ago, and the so-called Tesco riot that followed, when all of these foreign...
Telegraphic Heights, yeah.
It was called Telegraph Heights, it was a squat, wasn't it? And the police claimed that petrol bombs were being made in the squat.
Or was it Telepathic Heights, actually? It was, wasn't it? Telepathic
Heights. I can't remember.
On the Bristol, what they call the Bristol riots, or the disturbances on Stokes Cross.
Yes. I mean, you know, the police in Bristol, like everywhere else, are engaged they've got to balance various interests in what the decisions that they make.
Well, another story not related to the so political, although of course it's another lobby, that same lobby we were just talking about, the speculator developer lobby, which is doing so nicely under the Tories and our Tory blue Labour mayor Marvin Rees, building everywhere all over the city, including on Castle Park. And he loves saying things like, oh, there's cranes on the horizon, man. Well, he always talks in that American accent, but, you know, we don't necessarily want cranes on the horizon building these eyesores everywhere. Bristol Zoo Gardens review. Make sure you visit it before it relocates. Bristol's live parenting writer, Caprice Fox, has been visiting Bristol Zoo with her toddler, and it didn't disappoint. So it's open again, but it's going to be closed soon, Martin, because they're moving Bristol Zoo. The people that own the zoo have realised the land is worth more as luxury flats than as a zoo.
Well, I mean, that's a conclusion, if it's privately run, that they're likely to draw, isn't it?
Yeah, but how do they manage to get planning permission to build luxury flats there? Surely, I mean, as a zoo, it's a, you know, certain use class in the planning system, and they can't just go along and say, oh, well, we've decided we don't want the zoo
here
anymore.
Well, that is the whole issue in the Chesham and Amersham by-election, isn't it? Because they're ripping up the traditional planning laws, and they're basically saying anything can go anywhere. And that's exactly why there's been a reaction.
The zoo is due to permanently close in late 2022, so there's plenty of time to get a visit in beforehand. So whereabouts this is all going to move to, they're moving it to somewhere called Wild Place, and I'm not sure where that is. But the whole thing here is that where they're supposed to be you know, I would imagine a charitable trust running this zoo of some sort. And yet, no. What we're really doing is we're just doing deals with the developers to flog the land off, and because there's mega bucks in it for us.
Well, yes, and that is exactly, as I say, what has led to the government's defeat in the by-election on Thursday.
So, are you going to be? Have you been up to the Bristol Zoo?
I have. I've taken different kind of groups of kids up there.
I'm just trying to figure out where this Wild Place is. I mean, it's just such a tacky,
Africa.
It's a tacky name, isn't it? The Wild Place. Hey, that was
Antarctica.
A really great committee meeting that came up with that name, guys. We're going to call it Wild Place, man. And so that is well, I'm not sure quite where it is, Martin. So anyway, when you've been up to Bristol Zoo, just give us an idea of what it is, because it used to. I remember it from the Animal Magic programs when we were kids on Johnny Morris.
Yeah, well, I mean, I must have been up there two or three times in the last 10 years with groups of kids, and it is, you know, it is educational. It's nice to be able to see animals, although personally, I'm not really a big fan of zoos. Because, you know, you see tigers, and I don't think they've got tigers, but lions and other beasts up there, and they're clearly not, I mean, they're being well fed, but it isn't really natural. And, you know, they're doing their best to, you know, zoos are fighting a rearguard action against genuine conservationists who think that zoos are basically old hat. So, I think they're a bit like nuclear power. Zoos are gradually being phased out.
So do you know where this Wild Place is that we're supposed to go to, which is going to be so much more...
Well, they probably don't know, which is why they've called it Wild Place. Because if they knew where it was, then they'd probably tell us where it was, wouldn't they?
I mean, are you interested in the ethics of zoos? Is it? I mean, by the way, it's called the Bristol Zoological Society.
Well, I mean, the people's views on zoos have changed in my lifetime. I mean, they were regarded as a jolly good thing when I was a child and very useful and a way of conserving animals. And I suppose for some animals, I mean, I've been to Monkey World, which I was very impressed by, because all the monkeys in there have basically been rescued from captivity. So they don't go out into the wild to capture monkeys. They rescue them from captivity. So they're having a better time in Monkey World than they would have done in various, you know, laboratories and other places where they'd previously been kept. But, you know, with all the kind of technology we've got now for making wildlife films and so on, do you really need to see a scraggy lion in an enclosure looking sad when you can watch one killing an antelope in full colour on a widescreen TV?
So Bristol Wild Place, it says it's a really wild outdoor adventure from the Bristol Zoological Society, saving wildlife together and sticking it in a cage. You can even do things like adopt a bear there. But anyway, the main point here is that a whole load of money is going to be rolling into the Zoological Society for flogging off this prime piece of land. So that's the main, seems to me anyway, that's the main point of all of this.
Well, presumably they can then spend it on their charitable goals, which are, you know, whatever they are. So that's how they'll justify it.
Okay, so it's not far away from the original site. It's on, I think it's... gosh, Black Man Hill or some Black Boys Hill, somewhere like that. Anyway, so I'll put a link up to the wild place, wherever that is. It just seems to me unbelievable, this sort of thing, Martin, where they, you know, just move things like that. I don't like the idea at all.
No, well, I mean, as I say, it's because of the fundamental change in the planning. I mean, planning has always been pretty much in the pocket of the developers. But the current government have basically said, well, we're not even going to try and tell them what to do.
And, when it
and
comes
of course,
to,
there's been a reaction to that.
And when it comes to building, etc., there was a fantastic report, by the way, on ITV this week. Collapsed ceilings, mice and mould. The appalling conditions discovered across an entire housing estate of nearly 500 homes. Now, this was one evening this week on ITV on the main news. They really do seem to be, and it's Daniel Hewitt is their political correspondent, which is great to see a political correspondent actually going down to a housing estate and showing how terrible the conditions are. They're saying now that for years and years, although they've been paying their rent, these people in this Clarion, I think it's called Clarion Housing Association, haven't had any repairs done at all.
Well, I mean, as you know, housing is the major issue for the bottom third of the population in this country. And of course, it's important to the top two thirds because their pensions depend upon house prices rising, which means that the bottom third never get a look in for anywhere decent to live. And it's fundamental to everything that's wrong with the way the country's run.
So they're saying the UK's biggest housing association has admitted that it's failed tenants, but only after ITV News investigated found widespread disrepair, squalid conditions across the whole housing estate of 500 homes. Clarion Housing issued an apology to all its residents at Eastfields Estate in Mitcham, South London, admitting that they had not had the service they deserve. ITV News found shocking conditions on the estate, dozens of families living in damp, mouldy, crumbling homes with ongoing leaks. The estate is plagued by an infestation of rodents, with several residents showing videos of mice and rats in their properties, and the housing association saying it's not our responsibility, it's theirs.
Well, was this previously a council estate? I'm guessing that it possibly was.
No, well, you can guess, but we don't know. It's either a housing association built place or a council estate, Clarion, which owns 125,000 homes across the UK and this year recorded a turnover of £943 million, are accused by Eastfields tenants of abandoning them, ignoring their complaints for years. Housing associations offer more affordable rented housing, predominantly to people on lower incomes. Similar to council housing, housing associations charge generally cheaper rent than privately rented housing with longer tenancies. So, but it's just, the idea is that we're taking your rent, but you're not going to get anything for it. They've lost interest in actually maintaining and caring for the stock that they own.
Well, as you know, housing associations have been, they were based, as council estates were privatised, they've been selling off individual properties, obviously, but also in Bristol some years ago when I was working with the council, they tried to make all council tenants transfer to arm's-length management associations, and it was overwhelmingly rejected by the council tenants in Bristol, and Bristol is one of the few parts of the country that still has a fairly substantial council housing stock. But, of course, housing associations were supposed to be driven by social need rather than profit-making. But bit by bit, and you're a Knightstone tenant and you used to be on their board, as you know.
Knightstone don't exist anymore.
Well, indeed. But so, in other words, what's gradually happened is once the stock is removed from local authority control, the housing associations are bit by bit becoming the same as other property companies, just property maximising.
Okay, just sorry, I've just tracked down this wild place. I can't believe this. It's on the other side of the M5, up the other side of Cribbs Causeway, which is way out of town. For anyone that actually is in central Bristol wanting to go, or Clifton, wanting to go to the zoo now, they're going to be moving permanently out to, guess what, a very cheap piece of land near the motorway. So they're hoping to pick people up from cars from the motorway, and actually the people in Clifton and Bristol have been abandoned. This is exactly the same as what's happened really with the Aerospace Museum. There was because I was on the Cultural Development Partnership when they were talking about whereabouts to put the Aerospace Museum, because it was obvious that something was needed for the Bristol Aero Collection that was kind of homeless up at Kemble Airfield in a couple of big hangars up there, and there was a tussle with people saying, well, I mean, why would you put it right out of town in Filton? Why not put it somewhere near the centre? Because, you know what? It's because these people don't want to spend any money, and they know that that land is worth much more as student flats or as luxury housing. And so they're not providing the facilities in the centre. We had George Ferguson on this programme. I think it was not long after, actually, we'd been taken off of FM, the former mayor, saying that he actually deliberately set aside various bits of land in the city centre for exactly this purpose, which has now been used for, sold off to businesses and for luxury housing. One of them right next to the watershed, actually, a piece of land that had been deliberately put set aside by the mayor, by the previous councils, to be used for this sort of purpose, like as a museum. And the idea now is, oh, no, we're going to go and put it on a cheap piece of land right out of town where no one can get there.
Well, the same thing happened with the arena, of course. And it may well be viable out there on the ring road. You know, you're going to pick up people who are going to drive to it from Cardiff, wherever. But on the other hand, what does that do for unemployment and job prospects in South Bristol in terms of, places for people to work? So, you can see the way it's going is that the developers You know, the money now.
It's not for Bristol people, is this? This is for passing trade and also people coming from 100 miles away.
Yeah.
It's not for Bristol people and it's not really a Bristol Zoo anymore.
Well, no.
It's a South Gloucestershire Cribbs Causeway Zoo.
Indeed. And of course, if any profits from it were then ploughed back into doing things for people in deprived communities in Bristol.
They're moving their wholesale.
You could say that there might be a justification, but since they're not going to do anything like that, it's just yet more hollowing out, isn't
Bristol
it?
Bristol Zoo won't even be in Bristol. It'll be in Gloucestershire.
Well, it's going to be called Wild Place, isn't it?
Oh, I've changed the name. It's Conservation Park with African Animals. That's what it'll be. Anyway, I'm disgusted by the people that run these organisations that think, well, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll just cash in all of this and do something cheaper up the road. We've got the Noah's Ark Zoo Farm as well, by the way, which is much better, which is out in the countryside. Where is it near?
Well, that doesn't help anybody in Bristol.
It does. It's actually a lot easier to get to. You can get a bus out there. It's nowhere near as far away as the other side of the M5. Any more stories? I'm just looking around for other stories that we've got scheduled to look at this week. On this subject of landlords, the Lloyds Bank is going to become a landlord, Martin. I suppose the bank, they are, Lloyds, obviously, we've been covering for years here the various people who have been defrauded by Lloyds, and we can now say that for certain because we know that the police haven't properly investigated them. And that may be one of the reasons that Chief Constable Andy Marsh is taking a walk in a few weeks' time, is that it's been proven now, and there's a judgment by the law lords, that the Avon and Somerset police lawyers were saying, well, actually, there's nothing really to investigate at Lloyds Bank. And the law lords overruled them and said, yes, there is. Get on and investigate it. And the trouble is, of course, when you've got detectives who are also working for Lloyds Bank, I don't know where, whether they're moonlighting or what, but that's what we've seen anyway. So Lloyds are now about to become, they're in the process now of becoming a private landlord. I suppose the thing is that these banks have got the money to do all this stuff, whereas ordinary people don't anymore.
Well, I'd be very surprised if Lloyds didn't own loads of property all over the place.
No, but they're actually going to be managing the letting of it as well.
Well, that would, I mean, it's just...
They're cutting out the middleman now.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, you know, directly or indirectly, they must own loads of property.
Well, of course they do. But what we're saying here, Martin, is they're openly now saying that we're going to be the landlords. Now, in the past, they've facilitated these sorts of things, but they haven't actually been the guy you pay the rent to.
Well, it's, yes, it's more signs of the times, and basically the rentier economy is alive and well in Bristol. And it will carry on until such time as interest rates have to rise through some shock, and then the property market will collapse. It may collapse because of the collapse of retail. So things like Cribbs Causeway and so on, which at one time were massively successful, are now staring down the barrel of a gun. And plenty of property malls like that are not making any money. And the banks are very heavily invested in those, and that could bankrupt the banking system.
Anyway,
that's what's going to happen in the US.
Finally, a fascinating story. I found it fascinating. I know you're not that interested in the royal family, Martin, but I'm quite interested in the succession from the Queen to Prince Charles and how that's all going, because obviously these are sorts of things that in Saudi Arabia, the knives that come out. Well, maybe their knives come out here too. The Queen is apparently furious, according to the Daily Express. Prince Charles was given a royal telling off over the private delight at her abdication. Prince Charles was subject to the Queen's wrath after one of his royal aides told a documentary filmmaker that the Prince of Wales would be privately delighted if Her Majesty were to abdicate. So this is Prince Charles putting his foot in it, all right. The Queen is understood to have reacted furiously to the comments made on TV, which highlighted Charles's impatience to get on with the job. A royal expert said Her Majesty was hurt by the comments and ended up tracking him down while he was on an overseas visit to get to the truth of the claim. The incident was documented in a new biography of the Queen by Matthew Dennison, who said Prince Charles rushed to publicly apologise for the comments.
Well, it's he said, she said, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do we know what actually happened here? We don't. The Daily Express is saying that one
it's
lot of
It's not the Daily Express, Martin, no. It's a documentary.
Yes.
With one of his aides.
Yes, okay. So it's more than likely that he does want to be king and he wishes that she did abdicate. But she clearly doesn't want to, so there you are.
And wonder why? Because she thinks that he'd make a terrible job of it, perhaps.
Well, it may be just because she doesn't. I mean, basically, what I've read is that she feels that being the head of the Church of England and our line to God, it's up to God to decide when she goes.
Well, it's not so much not that anymore. Charles. It's not that anymore. I don't think the divine right of these kings and queens is really playing a role here. Although, of course, the faith of Her Majesty and Prince Charles is apparently completely different. Whereas he believes in a sort of multi-faith. I think he calls himself the defender of the faiths. That is, I say, all faiths. Mm. A kind of diluted version of the Queen and her Christian faith.
Well, I don't. I really don't know what.
Does it matter? Does it matter?
Well, of course it matters to some extent, but I think it's fairly clear that I think the Queen intends to die in harness. I don't think she's indicated anything else.
No.
So if he fantasizes that she's not, then he's obviously got the wrong idea.
Well, I mean, he could take on this much more important global role, potentially, couldn't he, with the Great Reshaft, as I'm starting now to call it, as one of my journalist friends suggested. It's not the Great Reset, it's the Reshaft, which I quite like that. Anyway, so Prince Charles is going to take a big role in that, and that's going to be an international role, Martin.
Yeah, he obviously wants to be a big player in these kind of issues, which, you know, from his point of view, I don't think he's incredibly wise. But, you know, at the G7, there was a big, you know, what are we going to do about the Great Reset meeting, which he was chairing, apparently. You know, don't forget that royal personages in Britain have long been involved in British politics. The idea that they're above politics is a bit of a myth.
Well, of course it is, because they can veto laws, can't they? Charles has been particularly vehement in saying, well, we're just striking that clause out, thank you very much, before it gets royal assent.
Well, that was the Queen as well, had that power. It only came out recently that they get to see all the legislation beforehand, and they can decide which bits can go forward and which bits can't, which nobody even realised. But, of course, that's actually been the secret. You see, because we've got a secret constitution that nobody's written anything down, it's actually just what actually happens is the constitution. And most people did not realise. For example, it's come out recently that they will not employ, or they did not employ, any black or minority ethnic people in the royal household, and that was a policy, but nobody knew about that as a policy, although we've now got documents that show that was the policy.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that they've managed to exempt themselves as well from these freedom of information requests.
Well, and they also exempted themselves from equal opportunities legislation, otherwise they would have been prosecuted, or they could have been prosecuted,
you know what?
I'm reminded
of this. You know, do you remember that incident in 2002 when Paul Burrell was being prosecuted for this mahogany box? I don't know if you remember that. It's to do with the death of Princess Diana. Mm. And apparently she had her, what she called, crown jewels hidden in a mahogany box, and which Paul Burrell took. And he told the Queen he'd taken some of her possessions. But nevertheless, a few years later, I suppose it would have been 2002, Paul Burrell, the royal butler, was being prosecuted for stealing Princess Diana's goods, including things like letters, which were apparently very damning from the Duke of Edinburgh, about very rude letters apparently about Lady Diana, Princess Diana as she then was, and also more explosively a tape recorded interview from the bedside of a palace aide who was friendly with Paul Burrell and with Princess Diana, who alleged that they had been raped by one of Prince Charles's staff. And this, obviously, this recording would have been absolutely explosive if it had been released. But what happened? Martin, I don't know if you remember it, but what happened was that halfway through the trial, the Queen suddenly remembered a conversation that she'd had with Paul Burrell and said, oh, well, actually, no, we don't want to prosecute at all now. We're dropping the prosecution halfway through the trial.
Well, call me unshocked.
Because, of course, the information would have come out in the trial. That's the thing, is the evidence comes out in these trials. And, of course, the royals were thinking to themselves, particularly Charles, I imagine, well, we don't really want this coming out. So I'll tell you what, let's just let Paul Burrell walk. That's fine.
Well, that's what they call a plea bargain, isn't it?
Well, I think it's called a crown prosecution, isn't it? Because that's basically the Queen is in charge of prosecuting all these criminal offences. Mm. And maybe if she's involved, she can just press a little button and everyone goes back home and there is no prosecution. And I think we had also on this show, we had the head of the South West Crown Prosecution Service, and he was absolutely clear. He said, we, as the Crown Prosecution Service, can prosecute everybody except the Queen.
Yeah, but I mean, if you go on the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme expeditions, and for example, you die by some mischance because, you know, your canoe overturned.
You've done something risky or whatever, yeah, or maybe got exposure
cannot,
or something.
You cannot sue because it's the Crown that's responsible for the Duke of Edinburgh's award. The same thing happens with the army. If you die on exercises, you cannot sue. And that's the way they get out of it.
Well, hang on, because we have had prosecutions for example, in the Brecon Beacons, where some soldiers were died. You know, so that's been through the courts, yeah.
Well, I understand that the Crown is beyond prosecution. But even in other words, they're not subject to the same rules and regs as everybody else.
I think everybody,
because we don't have a written constitution. There's no rules.
Everybody who's immune to prosecution, including these big corporations, the head of these big corporations, including the Pfizer and people like that, etc. I think they should go around with a special kind of hat, a silly hat on, so we know who they are.
Well, they wear enough silly hats,
because
they're
above the law. They're above the law. Anyway, so we're going to be back in a minute. We're going to be talking COVID, and we're going to be talking about the Biden-Putin meeting over in Geneva, etc.
Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Beatlemania is putting the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of pain. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is within. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't wanna shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Engines stop running, the wheat is going thin. A nuclear error, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning.
Remember 1979 Christmas, that was just the Christmas after Margaret Thatcher got elected. We'll probably remember that song from The Clash. Joe Strummer singing, playing his guitar there, former squatter, actually, a guy that died in rather peculiar circumstances not long after the September the 11th attacks. Martin, you know, this is, I suppose, prophetic in a way. He's you know, talking about things like the ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. This is all, you know, this is 1979, as the Thatcher era is starting to kick in. They're saying, well, this is almost like a kind of mini Armageddon going on here in London.
Yeah, it was a very powerful album and a very powerful song.
And the 1970s, of course, there'd been quite a lot going on with squatting. I was finding it quite interesting. I was reading a book about squatting, as like you do, a terrific illustrated book. And it turns out that Piers Corbyn, who we're going to be hearing from in a minute, he was quite a major organiser of the squatters in Maida Vale, who had a very great success against the Greater London Council in actually saying, well, look, you know, you can evict us from here, but we're not going to go unless you find us somewhere decent to live. And eventually the Greater London Council agreed, and they did find him somewhere decent to live.
Well, he also was involved in Villa Road in Brixton, which I used to frequent quite frequently, as it were. And, of course, what happened at that stage in London was that squats became housing associations, you know, so they became housing cooperatives, and the housing.
This was seen as quite a, you know, threatening to the establishment, wasn't it? The idea that whole bunches of radical people who'd been living for nothing could suddenly turn themselves into an organisation which would provide decent permanent housing at very low cost.
Yeah, well, I mean, lots of things that we used to do have been got rid of after all these years of neoliberal
Well, not least of which is mess. By the criminalisation of squatting residential properties, that even if they've been empty for years. Anyway, last Saturday was called, I think it was called Freedom Festival in Glastonbury. Piers Corbyn was down for that, and we're going to be hearing from him a longer interview in a minute. But first, let's see, who is this guy? I mean, we've had him on the show a couple of times, and clips from him, etc. But I'm, you know, quite impressed with his squatting credentials from the 70s. But what's he up to now? And this is what he's up to now. And here he is speaking in Glastonbury last Saturday.
Rally here of about six people. And we went up the hill and I was subsequently apprehended by the law.
Just pausing that for a second, he starts off by talking about the original anti-lockdown rally that they were doing around about a year ago, where there were six people there. Now there's thousands down in Glastonbury for what they're calling this Freedom Festival. Anyway, I'll let him carry on now.
And now, 11 arrests later, we are here! And we've had... And in London, we've had a march of a million. So from six people here and half a dozen or so in other parts of the country, we've got to a million, and we've got to keep growing. Yeah. Okay. Now, I want to thank everyone in our movement. There's a banner there which represents as many as we can, but it's growing all the time. To get to this point, we've got to think about how we've succeeded and how we're going to carry on succeeding. We basically got a united front of people around simple common demands, namely to break the imposition of the New World Order. We're not here begging or asking the government for anything. We are taking back our rights. And I think the best slogan I can suggest is on Tony's T-shirt. I gave one away yesterday. It's resist, defy, do not comply. Resist, defy, do not comply. Resist, defy, do not comply. Thank you. And in the last few months, we've seen an astounding blossoming of creative combat against the new normal and new world order. I want to thank everybody involved in that. I mean, let's just think what we've done. In London, we've had Don't Take the Vaccine Back, you know, fantastic singing from Ramesh. That is brilliant. And it really upsets those bastards we're against. And in London also, we, and other parts, we set up Let London Live. Where's the... There we are. Let London Live. And as you know, that's a movement, but also a party. So I stood in the elections in London and we got... their official counting, this is. 55,000 first and second preferences, which is amazing considering we had nothing when we started. And we had no money and no publicity. So we're in big debt, of course. But... their figures are probably dishonest because they use the same counting system as used in the USA. When they're going to recount, they suddenly find that Donald Trump won Arizona. So, you know, we're looking closely into that, but they're not going to help us. We've also seen new waves of occupations. The lockdown, lockdown, sorry, in Shepherd's Bush. Shepherd's Bush Green, which is fantastic. And we had the occupation of the HMV headquarters in London, Bond Street, next to Bond Street Tube. That was fantastic. It lasted 3 days. And when the powers that be broke in illegally, the first banner they took down was the banner. It's disappeared from the front. Where is it? The banner. Where have you gone, Brian? There he is, he's here. We demand public TV debate with all sides of science on the vax dangers. That's the banner. They went straight in there and took it down. So we know what they're scared of. They're scared of objective scientific debate. And if it doesn't happen on the BBC, we'll be getting all the alternative media anyway to do it. For example, the Light Paper, and I would recommend the light paper to everybody.
So that's Piers Corbyn last Saturday, something called the Freedom Festival in Glastonbury. Well, it's certainly, it's one of the five big movements in the UK, Martin, isn't it, these days? The, well, you might call it anti-lockdown movement. It's also the vaccine sceptics. They're the same people, basically. Plus, we've got the Black Lives Matter, which you've been quite involved in. And we've got the Kill the Bill, and we've got Extinction Rebellion. And what else? Palestine, the anti-Palestine. So we've got five big movements actually.
Got the loyalists in Northern Ireland.
Okay, well, they're not in the UK, are they?
Well, they are in the UK at the moment.
Really? Where?
In Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
This isn't, we're not talking about something that might happen in Bristol or in London. That's what I'm talking about here. So that's a little regional thing, and it is quite small, really. In terms of these five movements. So, anyway, I spoke to Piers Corbyn yesterday, actually, and I was amazed to see, and I don't know if you, I mean, because you say he was involved in some squatting scene that you were in Brixton, is that right?
Yeah, he was well known in as one of the people who lived in Villa Road. So,
was he actually one of the organisers? Villa Road was a
derelict line of houses on Villa Road, and they took them over and did them up, and eventually, I believe it's still a housing cooperative for the people who live there. And of course, as I say, that was fairly standard in Britain, in London, in that period and elsewhere, that what had started off as squatting of derelict property became housing cooperatives. So I was involved in Kirkdale Free School. They had a housing cooperative, and they were given money by the housing corporation to buy houses, which they then housed people in. It's a far cry from what goes on today, where the property prices are going through the roof, and you know, people on low incomes can't get anywhere to live.
Well, he does seem like almost a jack of all trades, old Piers Corbyn, because not only is he involved in the squatting movement and the climate, but he's also one of the people who's been most vehemently criticising Boris Johnson for not opening the country up on Monday, which he was supposed to be doing. And there are two, promised to be large protests in London. One is on Monday, that they're organising, because they're protesting against the fact that the country is not opening up on Monday. And they're also there's also going to be another one of these. I mean, I don't like to say massive before it takes place, but they have been getting bigger and bigger. Every one of these roughly monthly Saturday protests that the anti-lockdown groups do seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So when I spoke to Piers Corbyn yesterday from his police station, he's actually squatting a police station in Tooting. I talked about all these various things, including some of his squatting past, but also we ended up discussing what is going to be happening over the next couple of weeks with the the failure of Boris Johnson to actually open up.
I'm Piers Corbyn, and I'm from stopnewnormal.net, letlondonlive.org, and part of the growing movement to set up, well, Let Cornwall Live, Let Bournemouth Live, Let the UK Live movement groups around the country. And I'm sitting now on a stairwell in the newly occupied for a week Tooting Police Station, which is a very large police station. It's been empty for some time and had a number of occupants, occupiers in it. And we occupied it as a part of a protest, and we got a banner out at the top saying, "We demand public TV scientific debate on the dangers of vax, modern vax, COVID vax, especially to children."
Well, it's interesting that you're in a police station, isn't it? Because, first of all, we've had a massive cutback in public services, and the police have become something, you know, we don't see them on the beat, really. They're just a sort of distant thing. The other thing is the police have played quite an important role in actually singling out the anti-lockdown movement for much harsher treatment. So is that part of why you're in a police station?
Well, part of it, I mean, what our objective with these large buildings is to make a point, a political point, use them for publicity, and also, where we can, housing homeless people on a temporary basis, I suppose, because they obviously are commercial buildings that we can occupy legally on a temporary basis. And there are some people living here 24/7.
I think people who are particularly those in rented accommodation would say actually for them, even though they're paying rent, it's still often just temporary accommodation. They get hoofed out after a few months.
No, absolutely. And now with the end of the eviction holiday, they were calling it. Well, has the eviction holiday ended or not? Because it was meant to end on the 21st, you see. So let's see what they do. Because if they're not going to open up everything, is the eviction holiday going to be continued?
Well, what they've done is they've been a bit sneaky, and they've announced that the extension is for commercial property, but they haven't said anything about the domestic stuff.
Yes.
Well, I find it quite amusing in a way, Piers, that you're in a police station there, you know, having been going for the Guinness Book of Records on number of arrests.
Well, it's the police station in the UK with the architecturally most significant prisons. It was designed by Gilbert Mackenzie Trench, who is also the guy. It's a top thing. It's a deco. He's the guy who designed the TARDIS for Doctor Who.
No.
So it's really quite appropriate.
So yeah. So if you disappear, everyone will know where you've gone.
That's right. The TARDIS took over.
But the problem is, of course, these architecturally beautiful public buildings are also valuable to developers who will rehabilitate them and turn them into luxury flats.
That is what they want to do. It's been taken over by a developer, and it was a high court case this morning where they went to seek possession. There's been no possession order yet served on the building, but it could well happen tomorrow. So people will be removed within a week.
Well, the other thing about this, Piers, is most people know you for your work on climate change and also, right, of course, the anti-lockdown stuff. But I know you in the past have been a squatter yourself.
Well, absolutely. We've got everyone from Elgin Avenue, Paddington, rehoused. Everyone numbers 9 to 51, Elgin Avenue, Paddington, rehoused on October the 15th, 1975, from barricades. And subsequent to that, the GLC gave in and gave tenancies to 10,000 squatters about 2 or 3 years
ago. Okay, so can you tell us...
The movement became massive.
In a nutshell, can you just take us through that whole episode and what you achieved there?
I was homeless. I had an argument about a rented security, a tenancy in a rented flat. We went to the rent tribunal, got the rent halved, and then we got a notice to quit. So my brother and I, not Jeremy, another brother, he said to me, "Piers, let's squat." And I said, "No, only hippies do that." But he persuaded me it was a good thing to do. So we took over some houses in the street and found there were loads of other squatters in it. And cut the long story short, there were lots of shenanigans with the GLC and Short Life Community Housing, which had allocated them half of the houses there. We won one court case, but eventually we had to get evicted. But the judge said to the GLC, you've got your possession order, but you should conduct your removal of people in conjunction with Mr. Corbyn," which meant, you know, they should rehouse us all, which they did. And then after that, movement carried on, and we had the general slogan of one eviction, two squats, by the way. So every time we got evicted, they went into more. And the movement was so large after Elgin Avenue that two years later, the GLC just gave in and gave tenancies to 10,000 squats in their properties.
Amazing. Well, look, I mean, we're in the situation now. It's very different in London, isn't it? Particularly,
yes.
I mean, it's the same
commercial properties. Well, you can do anything like this in the courts with.
That's right. Now, well, that was Ken Clark did that, but
yes.
The situation in places like, I mean, Bristol is nowhere near as bad as London. But why is it that the rents are so incredibly high? Because if you look at how much it actually costs to build a house, you're talking about something like 100 times more to actually buy it or rent it, you know, per month or whatever.
The cost of doing new building has never been as low as now. And the amount of homeless people in housing crisis has never been so sharp. So what we've got is a complete, utter contradiction. If things were fairly organised, then everybody could live at council rent or below. But you see, the way it's all worked is that the money to enable people to buy houses or whatever has to be supported so they maintain prices by whatever means necessary. And the consequence of that is there has to be a large amount of homeless people. If we could end homelessness, I think that a lot of loads of other prices, you know, all housing prices would go down. I think it's a complicated issue, but, you know, it's a fake market completely.
I mean, looking back to the 70s, there were actually some quite famous people, including musicians, who were also squatters and singing about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, Joe Strummer, of course, he came from Elgin Avenue area, 101 Walter and Moe, which is part of the Maydale Squatters group, which I was the organiser of. And Joe Strummer set up the 101ers Squatters Rock Band, which then turned into The Clash. So I'm proud to say I knew Joe Strummer.
Well, did you actually see him in playing, singing and whatever in his early days then?
Yeah. It was his early days in the Chippenham pub. Every week, it was the squatter, the Maydale Squatters Rock Band. And it was massively successful, as you know, because they then became the Clash.
When it comes to the lockdowns, we've now got the situation where we're going to have to wait another month.
Yeah, well, we're not waiting. Our view is, and a lot of people have been discussing this in the movement, that we break the lockdown now and open up everything. That means the nightclubs that are still excluded, all the hospitality industry, where they're resisting and opening up, we give them 100% support. And we're going around all over the place, ripping down all these COVID control nonsense notices. We've been doing that today on the tubes and other days, tubes and buses in the streets.
It appears they're saying that actually the Indian variant is causing all sorts of trouble, and we're going to have to be really careful because the people like you are spreading it.
Well, it's a complete lie. It's an absolute total lie. Michael Yeadon, of course, one of the ex-vice presidents of Pfizer, says that there's no difference in terms of immunity between these variants, so-called, and anything original, because the variants are just variants on an original. If you've had this thing and got well, as 99.97% of the population does, then you're immune to the thing and all variants. So the variant scare is a complete 100% lie.
But, I mean, you can't deny all these cases breaking out.
Yes, I can, because the cases, so-called, are from false positives from testing. They create more cases by doing more testing. And if they do more testing in, well, wherever, Burnley, then they'll find more cases. So if they're in the mood to lock down Burnley because they don't like people in Burnley, then they'll do more testing there and declare there's more cases.
Well, now, you're calling for a TV debate about the dangers of vaccines. We're seeing all this stuff on the TV all the time. Most people are fed up with COVID wall to wall.
Yeah, but you see, they don't have a debate. They have a brainwashing session where the fake science of Imperial College and Neil Ferguson and others are projected, and the proper science of a whole range of scientists like Dr. Vernon Coleman or Dolores Cahill and so forth are excluded from TV. And everything that's been said on UK Column News. I mean, that's massively superb information on there, but it doesn't see mainstream at all.
Well, no, they were also, the UK Column have just been taken off of YouTube as well. YouTube has kicked them off. So you're saying that Imperial College is doing fake science. I mean, Imperial College, I mean, surely Imperial College is one of the greatest colleges in the country.
Well, or it was. I went there, I graduated there in 1968, did some research there, and so on, was president of the student union there. But I tell you, then, the sort of rubbish that is turned out in the name of medical science wouldn't last a week, because people would say, look, you're making these claims, where's the evidence? Neil Ferguson is the most famous scientist in the world for producing insane predictions which fail. I mean, you know, there's loads of things, swine flu, etc. He predicted this, that and the other, none of which happened. So all this story about this COVID danger of, well, millions were about to die, but they didn't. I mean, it is rubbish.
Hang on, you have to have something called the precautionary principle, which is looking at the worst-case scenario. You have to do that.
Well, there's a precautionary principle for everything, and most of the, if you want to take things to their insane conclusion, you can. You see, for example, the chance of you dying from COVID is lower than the chance of you drowning. 400, if you're under 61 of, you know, good health. 400 people a year or less die of drowning in the UK. And that's less than people dying of COVID. It's about the same. It doesn't really matter. So, if you want to stop people drowning, as a precautionary principle, I suggest you issue them all with life belts. So the whole population should carry life belts around 24/7 in case of a flood. Now that would be a 100% safe precautionary principle. It would also be totally insane. But that is the level of sanity which this government is projecting. There's no need for any lockdowns whatsoever. There's no justification for them whatsoever. They are harmful to people anyway. Masking is harmful. Social distancing is a nonsense because people generate their own immune systems by interacting with others. And we in the movement, of course, have been going around for a year in open air demonstrating without masks and so forth.
So have you yourself had COVID?
Well, have I ever got... I've had some strong flus in the past, which probably were the same... Well, they were something similar, maybe, but I think this thing was essentially a manufactured thing, but it has lookalikes in, perhaps. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it.
Anyway, I felt ill
at times, but it certainly got better.
One of the things that quite a lot of people have said about this whole episode is we've got the Conservative Party apparently trying to destroy the economy. What do you think's going on?
Well, they're doing this on behalf of a new way backwards, I would say, called the World Economic Forum, which want to have a great reset of the world economy. Now, the banks are completely, essentially bankrupt. So, either we have to write off all debt, which would mean house prices go right down, of course, for example, or you have some mechanism whereby all the middle and working classes have their incomes crushed. And the tiny percentage of people running mega corporations win out. So it means destruction of all small and middle enterprises. And that is exactly what is happening. And that is spelled out, if you read it in reality, the World Economic Forum. They can to lock people down. So the COVID con is to lock people down into moving towards this. They're also now talking about a green lockdown, which is another complete nonsense thing about climate.
Now, look, the left has always been saying, actually, a universal basic income is a good idea. Maybe this is, there could be something positive comes out of this in that you have... No?
No. See, universal basic income is a selling point for the stupid people who think, yeah, that'll last forever. Well, no. What'll happen is you can have these basic incomes. Well, you've got supplementary benefit or whatever. It's the same sort of stuff. And because of the... economic crisis going, the world food prices are going to go up. There's been deliberate shortages created. You probably know, you may know that the actual food productivity of the Northern Hemisphere has gone down because of the actual cold from the new little ice age that we're entering. And also the World Economic Forum has deliberately sabotaged production or distribution in the name of COVID and not having lorries and so on meeting in places. So a lot of stuff has been destroyed. Yeah. And in India, they've done a massive trashing of food because preventing the harvest meant that the stuff rotted in the field. So there's going to be starvation in India.
Piers, you just said something about a new ice age. Now, that doesn't sound very scientific.
A new little ice age. Like happened in the 1600s, where there was periods of extreme cold, which we have now. We've got... The Thames froze over in Teddington Weir in February. The last time that happened was 1963, for example. So these things are coming.
Can you just tell us, for those that don't realise or maybe don't agree with you, it'd be interesting to hear your take on why you think that the whole sort of Greta Thunberg climate debate is somehow linked to COVID?
Well, completely. It's part of a green reset, if you like. It's another thing not to control climate, but to control you. Just like the COVID situation is not to control the virus, it's to control you. And the story they put is that man-made carbon dioxide is driving climate change. Now, that is completely untrue. The reality is that CO2 levels are controlled by the sea temperatures, because when the sea warms up, it will eject some CO2, and cools down, it will take it in. And there's 50 times more CO2 dissolved in the sea than in the air. So the sea will rule, and the sun rules the sea through general circulation patterns of things which are controlled by the sun. And we generally understand this in Weather Action. That's my long-range forecasting company. And from there, you can download a free scientific paper. Go to weatheraction.com, and it explains why the climate story is incorrect. And it's very simple in two points to explain this. One is that a million years of data shows that carbon dioxide levels follow temperatures, i.e. temperature goes up and then the CO2 levels go up. Temperatures go down and following that CO2 goes down. So CO2 is not driving things, it is being driven. The second thing is to understand their theory as put forward is counter standard physics. You see, they say a bit of CO2 in the atmosphere will kind of make it darker or whatever in terms of infrared wavelengths or any wavelengths in the upper atmosphere or just higher up. And that extra radiation from there, which be created, will come down to Earth and make it warmer. Well, of course, radiation goes both ways. So what they're saying is that because of this extra something in the air, then you're going to have transmission of heat from a colder body higher up, because the temperature goes down as you go higher up, from a colder body to a warmer body. So their theory requires violation of the basic thermodynamics. It is complete nonsense, and they know it, which is why they will never debate it.
There was a scientific
paper in the world which demonstrates the CO2 theory. There's loads of scientific papers listed in the document I've just referred to, which prove that the CO2 theory is nonsense.
Well, there are a couple of interesting episodes in the whole history of this climate debate. One of them is something called Climate Gate. Can you just sum up what that was about?
Ah, Climate Gate, yes. There was some emails in the University of East Anglia, where they discussed various things on how to suppress what me and a whole lot of other scientists were saying. And in these emails, loads of them, they talked about hiding the decline. They were basically how to fiddle the temperature data. And they also said that they're going to make sure that people by the likes of me, and I listed a few others, are never going to be able to publish in respectable peer-reviewed journals.
Well, that's not very good. It doesn't sound very scientific. And also, there's something else.
It's in their emails.
Yeah, there's something else called the hockey stick. Now, can you just explain what that is?
The hockey stick is using their fake data to claim that temperatures have escalated a lot in the last 50 years, basically, or more. But there's various versions of it. And it's called the hockey stick because it starts at low temperatures and suddenly or rapidly zooms up to high temperatures. And they're hiding the decline gains were connected with that in various ways.
Okay, but your present struggle with the lockdowners and the vaxxers, I mean, really, this is a David and Goliath struggle, Piers. You've got the whole establishment. You've got the whole establishment pretty much against you. You don't stand a chance.
Well, not so. I mean, there's many things I've won against all odds. I think the important thing to know is we had a demonstration three weeks ago, the biggest ever in London. Probably a million, or might have been only 800,000, whatever you want to say. But this didn't get coverage in the mainstream media. Now, that is incredible. The biggest demonstration this century doesn't get coverage in the mainstream media.
Well, some would say, wouldn't they? Hang on. Some would say that the Iraq war demonstration in 2003 was bigger.
I thought that was in before the start of the century. I've got some wrong on that. Yes, that's
well, you are. Maybe you get the silver medal. But
okay. But anyway, the biggest demonstration in the last last 20 years or no, or 50 or 10 years, whatever. It's a vast demonstration that has had no publicity. The Iraq War demonstration did get publicity, a lot of publicity. But Tony Blair just said, go to hell. But you see, this time, people are doing differently. They're not just walking around. They're saying, we're going to have to break all these impositions on us.
Well, there are more demonstrations coming up, aren't there? I believe there's something happening on the 21st of June, yeah, which is when everything was supposed to open up.
That's right.
So what's happening?
We are opening everything up, and so are others, i.e. we are declaring our own Freedom Day, and to hell with what the government says. And then on the 26th, there's going to be another mass demonstration, which I would say is set to be bigger than the Iraq War demonstration you mentioned.
That's Monday the 21st, is yes, the day things were supposed to open up. There's a demonstration then, and also on the following Saturday.
Sure. Yeah, and then the following Saturday, a massive march in London. The one on the 21st will be stuff in London, definitely, but also stuff all around the country for events where people are resisting.
So what do you put it down to, the fact that we've got this massive movement going on with people coming out onto the streets, but the BBC is looking the other way?
Well, they are controlled. The BBC gets shoveled money by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as does Imperial College, as does Channel 4. So we now have a situation a bit like, like it was in Nazi Germany when all the suppression of the media happened. We have the same type of thing, suppression of the truth going on. Joseph Goebbels would be proud of the BBC. As now.
Okay, Piers, where do people follow your work on online and etc.?
Well, in terms of the weather stuff, come to weatheraction.com. In terms of the and other, some mention of other things on there too, but the main sites to go to are letlondonlive.org and stopnewnormal.net. This is Piers Corbyn, and I'm signing off from Tooting Police Station occupation against the COVID con and demanding fair public TV scientific debate from all sides on the dangers of vaccinations, especially to children.
Well, I think that's a laudable aim that he's doing there, this idea of having a TV debate, Martin, on the safety of vaccine for children.
Well, as you know, Tony, I'm in favour of having a proper debate about everything, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to agree about it, does it?
What about this whole point that Piers and almost everybody that's not on the BBC has been making, that children are virtually immune to COVID, so what's the point in vaccinating them?
Well, I can see that point, but of course they can spread it. And it looks as if schools, I work in schools, have been the source of a lot of the spreading.
Well, if they catch it, surely they isolate and they build up antibodies, etc., don't they?
Well, I mean, that's what's been going on. I mean, in schools I work in, you know, one person's in, we're all in little bubbles, supposedly. And if one person in that bubble tests positive, then everybody has to go home and self-isolate and take tests.
Well, one of the things that Piers are saying there, I thought, I mean, there's so much in that interview from last night, and I think it's fascinating to get a bit of the background from his squatting days as well. Is this business about India, that they may run out of food in India? We've had this protest going on, I'm just looking it up now, since last November in India. What on earth is going on over there? A man was set on fire at the Delhi Haryana Trikri border. The man was identified as somebody. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff going on in India. We're not really hearing much about this. But what do you think is actually happening there? Because as I understand it, the international elite are basically getting rid of guaranteed food prices. And these are the things that have kept India fed for decades.
Well, if we're talking about the agricultural issue,
massive farmers protest, yeah.
Yeah, and of course that's been very influential in international affairs, because the Doha round of the World Trade Organization negotiations collapsed in Seattle because the Indians wouldn't deregulate their agricultural system, because a large proportion of the Indian population is dependent on agriculture, and that killed off the whole thing. That's been an issue for many years. What's happening now with Narendra Modi is he brought in USAID, had leaned on him, that's effectively the CIA, and of course he was complicit in this to get rid of cash, which he tried to do in India, which is, they were trying to basically get rid of all large denomination banknotes. They claimed it was trying to get rid of corruption, but it was basically, an experiment by the US deep state to see if we can get rid of cash in a country like India. He had to back down because, of course, large numbers of people, especially in rural areas, don't have bank accounts. So there's no way that they can just get rid of cash. And it caused all kinds of problems for small businesses. So that he had to back down on that. They're now pushing to get rid of the traditional system in India, which since independence, which used to be the same in many countries in Africa, which is that the government buys up at guaranteed prices the basic foodstuffs that small farmers produce to give them stability of income. And then they store that so that in drought years or whenever there's a problem, they can then release those stocks onto the market and keep the price stable. The same sort of thing used to happen in Zimbabwe until the IMF went in and stopped them. And of course, in lots of African countries, those systems have been broken down for years now. But in India, because they're a bigger, a stronger country, they've been able to hold out. And of course, Modi is really on the side of big capital from outside India.
Okay, so what about here, the wider point about not reopening for another 4 weeks? Would you question the wisdom of that, or do you think that's a good thing?
Well, as you saw, there was a debate in Parliament and a vote this week, and something like...
The Labour Party failed to oppose again, didn't they?
Well, they basically supported the government's line, although people...
The Matt Hancock line, Big Pharma line.
Well, you can call it whatever you like.
I call it the Matt Hancock line because, he's the guy that's representing Big Pharma and making most of these decisions. Boris is just standing by the sidelines twiddling his thumbs.
Well, the fact is that the overwhelming majority of MPs voted to extend the limited lockdown that we're in. So that was the decision.
So it's not a power grab then?
There's a power grab going on, which underlies the whole thing. As I say, it's a biological warfare attack.
This helps that power grab, is vote, doesn't
no,
it?
No, well, the reason why they've had to call this extension of the lockdown is because the government did not close off flights from India, even though Bangladesh and Pakistan flights from those countries were closed off because...
But they're not having any effect, these flights from India. There's hardly anybody dying of COVID at all in the UK. We're talking about a fraction of 0.01% or something. There isn't any pandemic anymore. Come on, let's just face it.
No, Tony, I'm not going to accept that.
So you're looking at the cases then?
No,
what about the people dying or the cases?
Can I just finish my initial point? Which was that they should have locked down, and they didn't because...
Well, you said this, yeah.
Because why didn't they lock down? Can I just get to my point?
Are we going back to March last year now?
No. Can I just finish my point, please, Tony? We've had 20 minutes of Piers Corbyn, and I'm just trying to make a point, and I can't
make
it.
Get on with it, then.
Well, I'll make the point. The reason why they delayed for 3 weeks the lockdown, which they eventually carried through, is because Boris Johnson wanted to fly to India to do a free trade deal with Narendra Modi. And, of course, this week, we haven't mentioned it in all the hours on the show,
there
has been a free trade deal agreed with Morrison.
He could easily go to India. He doesn't need to abide by these rules. Well, as we know, High Court judges, there's all sorts of elite are going around the world.
If he goes to India...
Executive jets. They don't need to lock the whole country down.
Yes, but if he goes to India, one of the things he'd have to agree would be that there should be free travel from India to the UK. And that's one of the things that when they talked with Modi previously about doing
a trade deal. It's not true at all. The Prime Minister can go to India and...
I'm not just talking about whether he can go to India. I'm talking about what the details of a trade deal would be.
As I just said... People in the elite are going around the world. They don't have to abide by the rules. The rules are there to affect ordinary people who are travelling around. And if you're a wealthy person, you can easily break the rules. And that's basically what's... The rules are there for the vast majority, not for the elite. As we saw with the G7, were doing no social distancing. They've flown in from all around the world.
When Narendra Modi has negotiated previously with British governments about a trade deal post-Brexit, one of the things he's been insisting on is when Indian students come here to study, that they should be allowed to stay on and work. Therefore, if you're going to do a trade deal with Modi, like he's just done with Morrison from Australia, you've got to give the right mood music to get a trade deal, which means you've got to keep the border open. which of course is what he did in the first place. He kept the borders open, even though they knew what was going on in Italy, because it was all about global Britain post-Brexit. We haven't discussed what's going on in Northern Ireland this week and trade deals, because we're talking far too much about COVID.
Well, actually, we did a whole load of stuff about Northern Ireland last week. We can't do everything every week,
well,
can we?
But Northern Ireland is actually changing very rapidly this week. There's loads of things going on.
Why are they moaning about not talking about it? Why don't you talk about it?
Let's talk about it. It's all to do. The reason why there has to be a border in the Irish Sea is because the EU have been offering Britain, well, why don't you just align your phytosanitary standards with ours? They're already aligned veterinary standards. And then we won't have to have lots of checks in the Irish Sea. The British government has said no to that because they want to do trade deals with Australia, America and India and other countries, which means that they've got to have flexibility on rules about food. Now, that means that ultimately there has to be a border in the Irish Sea. And there's no reason for a border in the Irish Sea if we accept EU phytosanitary rules. There doesn't have to be one. So the loyalists have been thrown to the wolves by the government so that they can do a trade deal with Australia.
Hang on, they've thrown themselves to the wolves. What do you mean they've thrown themselves to the wolves? And that's why there's been all these problems with the leadership of the DUP. Yep. It's because they've basically agreed to something which is stabbing their own voters in the back.
Yes, they agreed to Brexit. They pushed for Brexit. They had a position where they could easily...
No, they didn't agree to Brexit. They agreed to having a border in the Irish Sea rather than on the land.
No, they didn't agree to having a border in the Irish Sea. And what Johnson promised them was there wouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea on the basis that we wouldn't be changing the EU regulations. But, of course, the Tory right wing want to do trade deals with foreign countries, which means that there has to be a border in the Irish Sea. So the loyalists have been thrown to the wolves by the right wing of the Tory party.
Well, there wouldn't need to be any of this if there was just a border on the island, would there?
No, and that's already been agreed with the Irish and the British who signed, and the EU have already signed an agreement that there isn't going to be a border on the island of Ireland. That's what all the fuss about not getting Brexit through for years and years was all about. It's actually the Irish question.
So the DUP leader quit again this week. What happened there?
Well, what happened is Poots, who's a person like you, doesn't believe in evolution. He's a 6,000 years person. He's a very old-fashioned Protestant.
Well, I am very old-fashioned.
Well, indeed,
true,
and yeah. So is he. But anyway, what happened is they removed Arlene Foster because they weren't happy with her, because she basically, you know, led them into this impasse.
She sold out the unionists. Yeah, of course she did. She's saying basically that you're going to be with Southern Ireland rather than with England.
No, ultimately, there's an agreement made that they're going to stay in the single market because the majority of people in Northern Ireland actually voted to stay in the EU. The loyalists are the minority, even within the six counties.
This is all heading towards a united Ireland, isn't it?
Of course it is. And Arthur Scargill, who's a Brexiteer like you, made it absolutely clear there's no need to argue about any of this. Why doesn't the British government just impose a united Ireland on the unionists? And then we can have a
referendum on it? That would be far,
well,
far
that's
more sensible.
That is, in fact, what Sinn Féin have been demanding. But their resistance to that, the unionists don't want a referendum because they might lose it. And, of course, what will probably happen now, if we come back to the detail of what's happened now, they've appointed Girvan to be the first minister, but Sinn Féin have to actually appoint their second minister, Níosail O'Neill. And they said they were prepared to do that, provided the loyalists accepted the Irish language issues, which they've been pushing, like Plaid Cymru pushed Welsh language issues in Wales. And basically the British government said, whatever the loyalists say, we will bring forward some legislation on that matter, which of course they're entitled to do since they're part of the United Kingdom. And as Arthur Scargill argues, they could just be forced to go into United Ireland if a British government with a majority
says
it.
Which way would the vote go if there was a referendum in the North then?
Well, it's actually on a knife edge, and I think Sinn Féin would be unwise to push for it until they're going to definitely win. But of course, we've already had
the Scots.
Yeah, we've already had a referendum on whether they wanted to be in the EU, and it was overwhelming that they wanted to stay in the EU, which is why, of course, they're going to stay in the single market. And of course, that wouldn't be a problem if we'd stayed in the single market. But if we want to leave the single market, and apparently some people do, then that means there's got to be a border, and that means it's got to be in the Irish Sea. And ultimately, of course, the loyalists are now in a no-win situation, because if they don't accept what's been coming down from London, which is some legislation about Irish languages, and they're not happy with that, then there'll have to be an election in Northern Ireland to the Assembly.
So why is it an issue?
And of course, if there's an election to the Assembly, can I just finish?
Why is it an issue if someone is a creationist or not? I mean, surely that's a debate.
I just happened to mention it.
Which everybody is entitled to have, and they're entitled to their views.
All right, well, he's entitled to his view, but it's a minority view even within Northern Ireland, never mind the rest of the world.
Well, if you ask people about intelligent design, you find there's actually quite a lot of people that vote for that. That was a throwaway remark,
Tony, because it's not really that important to the circumstances. The real problem for them is this, is that... Sinn Féin basically said, we will agree to Girvan to become the first minister as long as this legislation is passed. They didn't want to do it. Sinn Féin then spoke to Brandon Lewis, who's the Northern Ireland minister, and said, well, will you push this legislation through? And he said, yes, he would. And on that basis, they nominated Michael O'Neill to be the deputy first minister. Now, they cannot have a government in Northern Ireland without agreement from both sides. And at that point, the loyalists kicked off and removed Poots, who's responsible for this negotiation. Now, what will happen probably is there's going to be an election to the Assembly in Northern Ireland, because if they can't agree, there has to be an election. What will happen in that election is Sinn Féin will be the largest party, and they will take the First Minister role. And at that point, the loyalists will probably say that they're not going to appoint a deputy minister because they don't want to be ruled by the Republicans. And step by step, the situation is moving towards a united Ireland slowly rather than faster. But of course, the danger is that it could flare up into conflict, especially over the marching season. The anniversary of the Battle of the Boyne is coming up next month, and that's when lots of things can happen.
Well, you got your say on Northern Ireland, but we're not going to be leaving COVID anytime soon. But one thing we will be talking about first is the Putin-Biden summit. Now, I suppose we can't really ignore all the photographs that were taken of the G7. So they were doing official photos, all socially distanced, wearing masks. And then some smart photographers with telephoto lenses down in Carbis Bay in Cornwall, Prince of Wales's territory, the Duchy of Cornwall territory that they were on, some people with telephoto lens took photos of them at the barbecue, and of course there was no social distancing going on at all. So are they just taking us for a ride?
Well, I imagine most of those people have been vaccinated, haven't they?
But so why are they doing that? You missed the point completely there, didn't you? Why are they doing all these photos of social distancing when they're not really doing that at all?
I don't know, Tony. Why do you think it is?
Well, it's because they're just doing a little theatre for the public, isn't
yes.
it? It's quite obvious. Anyway, so from the G7, this is one of the things that I rediscovered this year with, I think they're biennial, aren't they, the NATO summits?
I don't know.
Yeah, every 2 years, I think, is when NATO has its big get-together. So we had the usually it used to run like this, Bilderberg conference, and then you'd have the G7 the weekend after, and then you'd have the NATO summit every other year. But this year is a biggie, because you've then got this Geneva summit with Putin straight after the NATO summit. Looking at the actual design of the NATO headquarters in Brussels, from above, I mean, people may well have seen this, but I'm pretty shocked at the fact that it is actually four Zigrunes from the runic alphabet, which is what the Nazis used for their SS. So it's like two, basically SS, SS. And if you look at the NATO headquarters from above, that's what it says.
Yeah, but I wouldn't read too much into that.
Do you think these people actually do use architecture? I mean, we know they do, don't they, in the street plans of London, in the street plans of Washington, etc. There is a, particularly amongst architects, there's a bit of a nod and a wink to these secret societies.
That may be so, Tony, but I think it's very hard to prove and therefore not really worth discussing.
I think it's very simple to prove. You just need to look at it, and even a child could see it. But
anyway. The Pentagon is a Pentagon, isn't it? And we all know that that can be used in dark magic.
Well, I think you've just made my point for me. Thank you very much. And actually light magic,
if
too.
Dark magic exists.
And light magic,
if
too.
Any magic exists.
Magic. So you don't think magic exists, no?
You don't Well, you're a Christian. I don't think you believe in magic, do you?
You don't think witchcraft exists?
No.
No, not at all. It's all gone completely.
Never existed in the first place.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that's one way to look at it. I suppose you could be in denial completely.
Yeah, I think we should go around burning people.
Well, who said that?
Well, that's what they used to say.
You just said it, yeah. But anyhow, the more interesting, in a way, than NATO being a continuation of the SS, I mean, you know, maybe we could dwell on that a little more, because we've had NATO chiefs who have been former SS officers, haven't we?
The idea that the NATO intelligence structures were totally penetrated by post-Nazis, as it were, is definitely a runner. And it's actually irrefutable. The head of the BND, the German, West German intelligence services, was former head of the Gestapo. So nobody in Moscow missed that one.
What about the werewolves? Because we spent a long time over the years pulling apart NATO's intelligence's Gladio operation, and it's quite clear now that this was just a simple succession from the werewolf units at the end of the Second World War that the Nazis had in place. The idea was they would kind of put on civilian outfits or whatever and hang around and wait for the advancing Allied troops to come past them, and then they would conduct sabotage operations from the background. Now, that just got taken up by NATO in the Cold War and used actually to create terrorist events organised by fascists and by the P2 Lodge in Italy particularly.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's an awful lot. I mean, if anybody's interested in this, they should go to the internet and look at the Frankovich film about this, the Gladio films. But of course,
that was the BBC, wasn't it? In the
yes,
old
I know,
days.
But the copy on the internet is the one you put up there years ago, because the BBC have basically buried the film since it was shown in 1993.
Yeah, I mean, I did play some part of it. It wasn't my copy. It was from Falmouth. I believe Falmouth College of Journalism, and they had a copy on their system, and I managed to, you know.
Well, it was a video, wasn't it?
That's right.
So you digitalised it and put it up there, but of course the BBC have not put it up there. They showed it once.
They've never repeated it.
They've never repeated it.
A bit like the Diana interview.
I remember watching it in 1993, 3 1-hour documentaries on the Time Watch strand. And I thought, amazing, fantastic, it's great all this stuff's come out after all these years, because there's a lot of interviews with gladiators where they're basically admitting that they carried out all these bombings and assassinations.
Including Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Yeah, yeah, and the head of the SISMI, who is the Italian secret police, basically saying, well, yes, we did all of that. And there he is admitting it on the BBC. And you thought, wow, what an amazing film. But of course, it was never repeated. And you can't find a copy of it apart from the one you put up, which is actually from a VHS video.
So so they went from NATO in Brussels, the SS headquarters, to Biden went and flew on to Geneva, which I, as I pointed out at the top of the hour, is the centre for tax havens. Actually, it's a massive tax haven. It's also a place where people can keep their money secretly with numbered accounts. And if you've got a Swiss bank account, then one of these accounts, then you're not allowed to access on the internet what's in your balance, and you don't get sent a statement through the post. You have to pay for one of the employees of the bank to fly out to you and to sit confidentially with you and log in secretly to a laptop, and then he will show you your balance on the laptop. And that's how much they don't trust the internet, and they keep everything secret in Switzerland. So that was, I thought, interesting that they chose that as the venue for these talks between Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden. Martin, you and I both have done reports on this week. I mean, I've been into a little bit of detail there about my thinking on this, which is that really the Bilderbergers are now running the show here in the West, because they've spent the last 50, 60, 70 years in slowly infiltrating their people into the political system. And now the reason the Bilderberg conference supposedly doesn't happen and is supposed to have disappeared is because they've kind of done their job, really. They've got their people in charge. Many, in fact, 35, 40 of the former Bilderbergers are taking major roles in the pharmaceutical industry and part of this whole COVID business. And anyway, what do you make of the meeting? What, you know, what were you saying on RT this week about the meeting between Putin and Biden?
Well, I think they chose Geneva because it's where Gorbachev and Reagan met. And, of course, Switzerland is still ostensibly a neutral country. They could have met in Finland, for example, but that's a bit closer to Russia, and the Finnish government are actually relatively close to the Russian
but
government.
But the politics of Switzerland is more interesting than that, isn't it? Because they were the people whose Second World War and the First World War swirled around them, and they made all the money.
Well, indeed. But, well, I mean, they could have met in somewhere else.
Wasn't it Lenin? Didn't he go from Switzerland over to the Russian Revolution?
That's right, yeah.
What was the training he got in over in Switzerland?
Well, what he was doing in Switzerland is because that's where people went in exile. I mean, that, you know, he was one of the people in exile. Trotsky was there as well, and so on and so forth. Anyway,
actually, there's one of the Russian top Russian oligarchs is over in Switzerland now, isn't it?
Well, you can imagine that top oligarchs go to Switzerland quite a lot. Or I mean, London. They go to Davos or
London. Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? One of those weird things. Maybe it's nothing, but the flags are transposed, aren't they? The Swiss flag is the white cross on a red background. The English flag is the red cross on a white background.
Yeah, but it's a different cross. Anyway, we could, you know, we're getting diverted here.
Well, just talk about what you want to talk about.
So, in other words, what they were asking me what I thought was going to happen. And I said, well, the most likely thing is, it was, don't forget, this meeting was requested by the Americans. And the Russians could have said, well, we're not meeting with you. But they didn't say that. They said, okay, let's have a meeting. And on that basis, I basically was saying probably what you were saying. You can't expect anything much from this. This is really a meeting to show the world that we're still having meetings, even though you're, I mean, basically on a day-to-day basis, Biden and the US are calling the Russians all sorts of names, you know, killers, this, that, blah, blah, blah. Well, so the Russians would be within their rights, really, to have a sulk and say, we're not coming to the meeting.
Well, no, they're not like that, though, are they?
No,
they're much
not.
More mature.
Indeed.
Than
so
the
they came to the meeting, and I think what the Russian side wanted from the meeting, and I think they got it, was, okay, we recognise that in day-to-day politics, you're going to carry on throwing dog poo in our direction, but, you know, let's have a meeting just for the sake of it. And of course that is actually how you do business. If you're, whether you're trying to do the Northern Irish Peace Agreement or anything else, you never say no to having a meeting.
Well, one of the things that I was talking about on Press TV was the complete difference, almost like chalk and cheese, between Biden and Putin. Whereas Putin seems to be very much a manager who's in charge and in control, Biden seems to be almost like the perfect puppet president.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, because of the insistence on the US side, there were no one-on-one meetings between Biden and Putin.
Why is that?
Because basically, Biden can't be trusted to go into the meeting and not, you know, say something silly or sell, I mean, sell
we've
the farm.
Hang on, we've got sort of precedents for that, haven't we, in the past, where presidents have got chatting and arranged things that their aides didn't like.
Well, the classic one would be the Reagan-Gorbachev meeting in Reykjavik, so that would be another place where they could have met. And the Gorbachev said to the Americans, well, why don't you just allow me and Ronnie to have a chat, walk in the woods and a chat? And at that stage, the Americans were a bit naive and they thought, oh, well, we can't say no. So off they went and they came back out and gave a press conference where Ronald Reagan said, my friend Mikhail and I, we've agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. And of course, you can imagine the Pentagon people are at the meeting going, what? He said what? And of course, that was
so
a problem
why,
for them.
That's
why Biden is not allowed to go into meetings on his own with Putin.
Good reason why Biden is not going to be allowed to even have a little walk in the garden with Putin on their own.
That's right.
What sort of things they might will come up with all sorts of amazing what that implies immediately there to me, Martin, is that the advisors, the people swarming around the US president, are the problem.
Well, they are the administration. So from the Russian side, if you want to bring your top 400 people here, then that's fine. We're not just talking to Biden, we're talking to Blinken, who's the equivalent of Lavrov. You've got loads of, you know, career military and spooks and diplomats there. They're the ones they really want to talk to. So the Biden-Putin bit, Biden and Putin could basically have just sat and had a cup of tea while the rest of them got on with it.
Well, yeah, but they wouldn't be allowed to do that, would they?
Well, no, because the point is what probably...
We can't trust the president to be in charge.
I understand that there was a meeting with Biden and Putin and Lavrov and Blinken all in the same room. In other words, but you see, Putin could easily have...
Blinken is his minder.
Yeah, Blinken is the representative of the deep state in the US. And they asked me on RT, well, what do you think about this cybersecurity stuff? And of course, the Russians have been saying for years, if you're worried about cybersecurity, why don't we get together and come up with a treaty on cybersecurity? And the Americans have always been resistant. And I basically suggested that's because the US uses cyber warfare frequently. We were talking about Stuxnet earlier. And it's quite
like the Israelis, wasn't it?
Well, that's, and the Americans. I mean, Obama basically boasted that they were there.
Is there any difference between the two?
Well, there is, but I mean, the point is they were both in on it. And the point being that here is that the point I made was that these recent cyber attacks in the US are quite likely orchestrated provocations by the US deep state. So it's not just
the Americans themselves and the Brits. I believe the Brits, certainly the Americans, have said, have stated in their policies, military policies, that it is virtually impossible to tell where a cyber attack has come from. So it's all very well them saying, well, if we get a cyber attack against us by Russia, we reserve the right to fire back with nuclear weapons.
Well, that, indeed. So that's why from the Russian side, they want to say, well, if a cyber attack could launch a nuclear war, maybe we need some agreements about cyber attacks. But it's very difficult to do that because the deep state in the West uses cyber attacks as a standard operating procedure. And they don't just mean cyber attacks on the Russians, although they threatened to take down the Moscow Underground, for example, which the Russians were disgusted by. They will take down their own, I think, the ransomware stuff that went on recently in the US,
in the UK with the NHS.
The ransomware in the US was particularly interesting because the FBI cracked the case immediately and were able to get the money back because they knew everything that was going on. And that tends to suggest that they were the ones who orchestrated it. And of course, that makes them look good because they captured the people who did it and they got the money back. But at the same time, they can point the finger at the Russians and say, ooh, you terrible people, you're carrying out cyber attacks on us. And of course, you've got all these other sources of tension, you know, the Belarusian business, the Ukraine.
We've had the Skripal affair, which we've pulled apart as much as we possibly can. And there's a completely different narrative to that, which the BBC have been putting out about this and others, which is all really to do with the Skripals, Victoria, Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal. Both being basically this whole thing being used to keep them in Britain because he wanted to go back to Russia, and he'd written a letter to Putin which had been intercepted by the British saying, I want to come back to Russia, if you give me a pardon I'll come back. And of course they couldn't allow that because he knew fantastic amounts about what MI6 had been up to.
Yeah, I mean, the Russians are very well aware of all of these things, and they could have taken the line. I mean, in a previous era,
they don't talk about it much on RT, do they?
No, because the point is that certain things are not to be discussed openly they're supposedly secret.
Well, they let it out, but they don't rub it in their face,
no,
do they?
General Suvorov during the Napoleonic Wars was a bit of an old fashioned general. But he basically always used to give the enemy a golden bridge. Napoleon always went for annihilation. So you surround them completely and you annihilate their forces. Suvorov's policy was always give them a way out.
Yeah.
Let them retreat.
Well, this is a far more mature approach. And actually, it was interesting because, many people in the press, including myself, were criticising Biden for being a puppet. Well, when he came on to do his press conference after the Geneva meeting, Putin was at pains to say the opposite. He's saying, actually, this Biden guy, he's on the ball. You know, he's a really difficult guy to handle, and nothing will go past him.
Well, I think what he's doing there, to be fair, I mean, we're on the internet now and we can say what we really think, is he's being nice to Biden because they do not want a war with the United States.
It's
so they're quite prepared to pretend to, they know that they need the right
move. They're buttering
him
up, maybe.
Yeah, they're buttering him up. If they went out and said, well, they're trying to encourage a more responsible, mature attitude, not just from Biden, but from the whole 400 people that they met. I mean, the heads of the military from both sides were there. Everybody in the world should be really pleased about that the top military from Russia and China and the US
the
are
really positive,
sitting down and having a chat.
Positive.
What's the matter with that?
That came out of it was that the ambassadors are going back.
Yeah, so in other words, the expelling of the ambassadors previously allows them to have at least one win. Yeah, doesn't it?
From the meeting, yeah. Well, it's, I found it fascinating. Also, Putin did an hour-long press conference afterwards, and I think we're going to hear now from Vladimir Putin. Well, it's on. Obviously, he's not talking in English, and it's translated. But here he is at the post-Geneva meeting press conference talking about the questions. Was the issue of Alexei Navalny brought up? Do you want to just say briefly who he is?
Well, Navalny, as you know, has been a thorn in the side of the Russians for a long time. The Russian view of him is that he's basically a foreign agent. and that his political movement is, which has actually got less than 3% support in opinion polls. So the way he's being presented as some kind of challenger to Putin is absurd.
Well, he's
the
he's
real
also...
challenger to Putin is the Communist Party, which is Grudinin, and the other challenger is Zhirinovsky, who's a very right wing liberal democrat party, not like our liberal
so
democrats.
He's been that... falsely painted in the
yeah, he's been painted
Western
in the West
press.
As if he's some kind of savior
major
of Russia.
Figure, you know,
and of course,
he's not
at the same time,
he's got no real political traction at all.
He hasn't, and in any case, he was
except
convicted
on the BBC.
He was convicted of fraud, which is what led to him, you know, having bail conditions and so forth. And the West simply says, "Well, the fraud conviction was just politically motivated." Mm. But I mean, you know,
well, that's convenient,
it,
isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah.
So also the when he was talking about Alexei Navalny. Putin was, I mean, here he is responding to questions about him. It's also, of course, our own, very own, Labour mayor, supposedly Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, went on to Sky News a couple of months ago, saying what a great guy he is, even though he's an unrepentant racist, Navalny. So let's have a listen now to, Putin talking about this whole Navalny episode and how he is responding to it.
From the American side, the issue of political prisoners. But have you even discussed the personage of Navalny himself? We have all seen in this new stage of Russian-American relations with the new administration. It all started with a very rough statement towards you. Have you clarified this, perhaps?
President Biden talked about the human rights and about the people who think that they represent all these matters in the Russian Federation. Yes, we talked about it by his initiative. So that's first. Secondly, about some rude remarks. Well, what can I say? We all know about these remarks after that President Biden called me. We talked about it. I was satisfied with his explanation. He suggested to have a meeting. It was his initiative, so we did. And once again, the conversation we had, it was not how we talk with all the leaders, like face-to-face and in such a detail. As for the accusation, his predecessor, he was answering the very same question, if you remember it. And the president of the USA decided to answer in this fashion. Everything that is happening in our country is one way or another. The political authorities are responsible for this. Leaders are responsible. They carry this responsibility. So who is to blame? Who is to be accused? Who is the killer? Someone is getting killed in the American cities every day. And the leaders of various organizations as well. So because they will start shooting... You can hardly open a mouth without getting shot. And so a woman was running away from a car and he got shot in her back. But okay, these are crime news. But let's look at Afghanistan. With one strike, they killed 120 people, destroying, annihilating weddings. So, okay, that was an error. It happens. But using drones to fire at, or using helicopters... firing at civilians, obviously, people who are civilians. What is that then? So who is responsible for this? Who is the killer then?
Well, he's Putin there comparing this alleged attempt to kill Navalny to a drone strike killing 100 innocent civilians in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and of course he didn't mention Guantanamo or all of the secret prisons that the Americans run around the planet. Or the assassination.
I think at another time he did mention Guantanamo at one point.
Well, he did. He also mentioned the Capitol riot, so called, in which 7 people died, including somebody shot dead by the police who was unarmed. You know, the US is not really in a strong position to accuse Russia of not having a rule of law. Navalny has been convicted under Russian laws of various offences, and that's why he's serving time in prison.
Basically, he's saying this is really nothing to do with me anymore, because
the courts are doing what they're doing.
Are you expecting me to phone up the chief prosecutor and say, drop this prosecution?
That's right. That's right. That's exactly
what the oligarchs used to do with Yeltsin all the time, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's actually how states become corrupt, is where you get presidents who are throwing their weight around and deciding who can and who cannot be prosecuted, such as, you know, the same, well, we're talking about the same kind of thing to do with, over here, Martin Bashir, and whether he should have forged documents in order to get an interview and whether that really made any difference or not.
Yeah, I mean, the Russian system is inevitably, you know, a product of historical circumstances. And therefore, it's far from ideal in terms of equal access to justice and so on. But then the US system is also a product of historical circumstances, where the police in the United States kill 3,000 people every year with no consequences.
Well, we've had also, we're going to look now a little bit at censorship. We had Apple Daily, massive raid by the Chinese on them in Hong Kong, Martin. I mean, it can't really function. Any kind of society can't function if you haven't got journalists doing their job. And not only is the guy that owns the paper being sentenced to jail term, you now got the editors, the senior editors of the newspaper at Apple Daily in Hong Kong being, well, they were arrested yesterday and then on trial. They're going to be on trial very soon.
Well, of course.
And this is no way to behave, is it? I mean, much as you're a fan of China, surely you can't back this.
Well, at the same time, the Chinese are just going to say...
Do you or not? Come on.
Let me just...
Answer that question.
No,
do you
I'm
think
not...
it's okay that the Chinese authorities...
Is
are
it okay to put
no.
Julian Assange in prison?
Answer the question. Well, we know that's not, but answer the question. Is it okay for the Chinese authorities to come and arrest the editors and the owner of Apple Daily in Hong Kong?
What they will argue...
Is that a yes or no?
Can I just finish?
Is it yes or
I'm
no?
just coming out with what the Chinese line will be.
Well, what's your line?
What they will argue, and I would agree with what they would argue...
You just parrot them, do you?
No, I'm just saying what their line is. They say that these are foreign agents and they're funded by outside sources. And they're absolutely right, because they are. Now, that doesn't mean they should be arrested. It doesn't mean they should be persecuted. It may well be that the Chinese are overreacting. But when they say these people are being paid by the National Endowment for Democracy to undermine our system...
Apple Daily is National Endowment for Democracy.
I'll bet you they've got
You've
money
got
coming in.
You've got your fingers crossed there, have you?
No. I think it's pretty clear from the Chinese side that they know very well that large amounts of money has gone into Hong Kong to fund these opposition activists. They don't live on the kind of money we
They're
live on.
They're not opposition
Tony.
Activists, are they? They're newspaper proprietors,
yes,
and they're editors and journalists.
Now, we've discussed in previous weeks the possibility that there's been a biological warfare attack on China. Now, in those circumstances...
And on the West, not just China.
Oh, yes, but the Chinese to take the brunt of it. Now, if the West had a more constructive attitude, then the Chinese might be able to tolerate more criticism. But if we're all going to war, and you're sending your aircraft carrier to intimidate us, and you're paying these people to do this, that, and the other... then we are going to arrest them. And it's very unfortunate. I think everybody should be allowed to have their say. But you can see from their point of view, they're not prepared to tolerate it.
It would have been nice to hear you condemn the arrest of the journalists. But anyway, we're not going to hear
I'm
that.
Saying, so no, I'm saying this. It's a wrong let's, move by the Chinese, but you can see why they think as they do.
Yeah, because they're authoritarian and they don't like anyone
criticizing. Because they're threatened
they
by the West.
They don't like criticism.
The 9/11 attack was carried out from inside the US security forces.
It's nothing to do with 9/11.
That's 3,500 people dead.
The Chinese Communist Party will not accept criticism. President Xi won't accept any criticism. If you so much as criticise him in the street, you're under arrest. Anyway, we do things in a very different way here in the UK. And what we do in the UK...
Yeah, we assassinate people like in Northern Ireland.
In the UK...
You don't lock them up, you shoot them in the head.
In the UK, what we do is we block any kind of certain aspect. In fact, there's a whole load of doctors that have been told that we're not going to be hearing from you whatsoever, either on YouTube or on the BBC. And one of our musician stars this week has come out with, I thought was a fascinating video. That's Eric Clapton. He's actually done a not all that amazing, but pretty good anti-lockdown song in the past. But then he had his vaccine, but it didn't go down too well. So let's have a listen to Eric Clapton talking about the reaction he had to the vaccine. Now, of course, the result of the British press quashing and squashing and spiking all the stories to do with bad reactions to the vaccine, or at least as many as they possibly can, is that, of course, people think, oh, the vaccine's fine. Well, it isn't, as we'll hear right now from Eric Clapton.
The vaccine took my immune system and just shook it around again, and that's still going on, so... Then I read, you know, a lot of the evidence that I had been reading about with people that were having adverse reaction. That was on the list, was, you know, damage to the immune system.
Do you feel like you were made aware of those risks beforehand?
Oh, God, no. I lost the use of my hands for about 3 weeks. So I thought I was in real trouble. And that's about that point. I was invited by Robin Menotti to talk about it because it was easy to say yes, because I realized I'm definitely, by then I realized I wasn't the only one that was suffering. And that's my experience from having had the second jab. But now I've stopped watching TV. One of the cartoons was a little drawing of a guy interviewing two Quakers and saying, how come none of your community has got COVID? And they said, well, we don't watch TV. It's so true, man. There's so much of the sickness is in our heads now. And I experience it. You get caught in the trap. Well, can you believe what your heart tells you is right? Or is it going against the narrative? Can I talk about how I feel to my family? Man, doesn't get riskier than that. When I made that little statement, I was pleased to see that it went around without too much of flack. I did get some flack from the people I least wanted to get flack from that. My fear about vaccination is, what will it do to my children? Part of the reason, maybe the biggest part of the reason why I'm talking here today with you, to talk to my daughters about they may not be able to have kids, they don't probably care. You know, at that point in time in your life, it's not an issue. Yeah, that's one of the risks I take by doing this, is that, you know, they're gonna.
Well. That was Eric Clapton. I mean, it's amazing. In any kind of normal world, you'd expect that to be the main headline news, Martin. Eric Clapton was rendered so he couldn't use his hand for 3 weeks after having the vaccine.
Well, we've been debating vaccines on this show week in, week out, and that is another opinion about vaccines, isn't it?
It's not an opinion.
Well, he's had an effect from it, on it, on him. He's not dead, though, is he?
It's not an opinion, is it?
Well, it is an opinion,
no,
of course.
It's not an opinion, it's a fact.
It's a fact Eric that he's had a reaction to the vaccine.
Eric Clapton, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's only Eric Clapton. Of course, there's no need to have that on the BBC. Why would anyone be even vaguely interested?
Well, you know what's going on, Tony, is the government in particular.
The pharmaceutical industry.
The government in particular.
Not the government, the pharmaceutical industry.
The pharmaceutical industry is way too powerful. You know, I understand that. But the government pushing the vaccine, because it's basically the only thing holding them up in the opinion polls. They're determined to get everybody vaccinated so they can open up. And well, they haven't been able to do it.
It is interesting, I think, that quite a lot of reporters are getting fed up with all of this. There's a woman called Ivory Hecker over at Fox in Houston this week that decided she was going to speak out about it live on TV. That's the way to do it, girl.
Well, high temperatures over the past week are leading to a lot of air quality issues. And so we're also talking about air conditioning outages across the region. Fox 26 reporter Ivory Hecker is live in Montgomery County to take a look at that aspect.
Thanks, guys. That's right. Before we get to that story, I want to let you, the viewers, know that Fox Corp has been muzzling me to keep certain information from you, the viewers. And from what I'm gathering, I am not the only reporter being subjected to this. I am going to be releasing some recordings about what goes on behind the scenes at Fox, because it applies to you, the viewers. I found a nonprofit journalism group called Project Veritas. It's going to help put that out tomorrow, so tune into them. But as for this heat wave across Texas, you can see what it's doing to AC units.
So there's a news item about air conditioning units in Houston, and suddenly she goes on to a whole different topic, Martin, saying, actually, what's happening is I, as a journalist, are being muzzled by my network, and if you want to find out more about it, you're going to have to go to a different website called Project Veritas. I wonder if Ivory Hecker has still got her job.
Probably not, because it's within Fox's power to sack her. So that's what's going
to
happen.
But
it's
great to see people bravely coming out and saying things. I can remember years and years ago having a chat with a Danish guy who said they had a very well respected, as they are not, of course, anymore, newsreader in Denmark, who had been doing it for decades, or certainly a decade or so. And he said, at the end of one of the bulletins live on Danish television, he said, and that is what we decided to tell you tonight. And that was just the final episode before he was due to retire. So it is quite good, I think, to see that there are quite a few journalists out there who are prepared to lose their job and also prepared to dish the dirt on the networks that are trying to control what they say and think. So we do it in a kind of different way here to the Chinese, Martin, don't we? It's a bit more subtle.
Well, there's a subtle management of news agendas and so on. As I mentioned in Northern Ireland earlier, you just kill people. Cathy McCarthy was killed aged 23 in Queen's University Belfast Bar by a loyalist death squad. Most people thought that she had the potential to be a future president of Ireland, but most English people have never even heard of her, and she's not been suppressed by being stopped from going on the BBC. She dead.
Well, there's all sorts of ways you can do this, I suppose. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, the International Federation of Journalists do, and even the National Union of Journalists do fantastic work in actually exposing where journalists are being killed for actually trying to bring the truth to the public. It's happening more and more. And not only killed, but arrested, etc. But anyway, we're going to hear now. I mean, we've been doing this for weeks and weeks, actually since the beginning of this year, looking at Tucker Carlson in the States, Martin, and also the British guy, Steve Hilton, who was a rather crooked advisor to David Cameron in a previous life, but somehow has been snapped up by Rupert Murdoch. And he's now on Fox News over in the United States. He's now an American citizen, amazingly, fast track that he's got. There's been some results of all of this, the coverage of Dr. Fauci over there funding this gain of function research. Isn't it incredible? Do you think that someone is a public official who's been exposed as a liar again and again as being behind the funding of the gain of function research, which quite possibly led to the creation of this virus, is still in his job?
Well, the reason for that, in my view, is because it was a deliberate attack on China. And, of course, if you start accusing that the Pentagon funded the gain-of-function research in the Wuhan lab, that's been established.
Well, someone definitely wants to keep a lid on this.
Yes, and the reason they want to keep a lid on it, because if they start blaming the Chinese for leaking accidentally from the lab, the Chinese are going to come out and say, well, we don't think it's an accident. We think you did it to us deliberately, and that means we're going to sink your aircraft carrier. Bang, suck on that. And, of course, as a top Chinese admiral has already said, the way to stop all this nonsense in the South China Sea is sink a couple of their aircraft carriers.
Anyway, the American political system, even, you know, it's not quite like China. It does move, amazingly. It does actually churn and things can happen. So we've had the Republican Senator Marjorie Taylor Greene.
She's not a senator, she's a congresswoman.
A congresswoman, sorry. Sponsoring the Fire Fauci Act. And here she is with some of her Republican colleagues this week talking about introducing legislation to get rid of Fauci.
Thank you for coming, everyone. This is an important issue that we need to talk. The American people have endured terrible things over the past year due to the shutdowns from COVID-19. And I'm very proud to sponsor the Fire Fauci Act, and I'm grateful to my colleagues here for co-sponsoring this bill because the American people deserve answers.
The Fire Fauci Act will bring Dr. Fauci's salary down to zero and also will require the Senate to confirm someone to fill his position. You see, Dr. Fauci was not elected by the American people. He was not chosen to guide our economy. He was not chosen to rule over parents and their children's education. But yet, Dr. Fauci very much controlled our lives for the past year. Dr. Fauci, there is a lot of information that needs to come out on him. And as you all have seen with the emails that came out, that he owes the American people a lot of answers, but he also owes the world a lot of answers. These are emails that are very important that you all need to make sure that you're sharing with the public because the public has suffered greatly. Businesses have closed. Small businesses have suffered. People have truly been depressed. Health consequences. People have died alone in hospitals and nursing homes. Children's education has been delayed by a year. And then we even witness suicide numbers going up, not in just adults, but young people, people in college, children in high school, children in middle school, and even younger. This isn't how our country was set up, and this is not how people should be governed. But yet it's Dr. Fauci and through his advice that constantly changed. That is how things happened. You see, there's a lot of evidence and answers need to be found and answers need to be given. And the American people deserve the answers and accountability should be held for Dr. Fauci and all of those involved. And if American tax dollars went to the Wuhan lab and indeed funded this virus, which it's very clearly coming out that this is very much a man-made virus in a lab that has sickened the world and caused people to die. You see, people are really tired of there never being anyone held accountable, never anyone being fired. And that's why it's time to fire Dr. Anthony Fauci and give answers to the American people who, I mind you, this is the government that should be serving them, not the other way around. So I would like to go ahead and introduce Mr. Massey from Kentucky.
Thank you, Marjorie. I was honored to be Marjorie's first co-sponsor on this bill because I've said for over a year that Dr. Fauci needs fired. I realized this the first time he joined us on a conference call, and there were questions he couldn't answer and wasn't even concerned about answering. Like, when would we open the government back up, or the government and all the private businesses? When would we open it back up? What were going to be the qualifications for that, since he was going around to every state saying shut it all down? The other question he never answered, still hasn't answered, is what are the bad health effects from the shutdowns? You need to take a whole of health approach to the response to this virus, and he never did that. He's a political scientist. He is not a scientist. He is a political scientist. He has admitted, and it's hard to believe, but he's admitted that he fudged his own answers about what level would constitute herd immunity. He said, well, I didn't think the public was ready for that number, so I gave them a different number, and now I'm going to give a different number. And never in between there did the science change. So we need to fire Fauci. We need to do the investigation of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. And my hat is off to Ron DeSantis, who saw through this fraud early on. Florida chose freedom over Fauci. Governor DeSantis banned Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx from coming to Florida and speaking to the government employees there and giving the imprimatur of the federal government to force these private businesses and schools to close. So with that, I will turn it over to Mary Miller.
Sorry, Mary. Thank you. Thank you, Marjorie, for introducing this important piece of legislation. I signed the Fire Fauci Act because it was under his direction and support as an unelected and overpaid government bureaucrat that the shutdowns and masking of our country was ordered. It's cost us, we can't actually estimate the costs. We will see in the future the actual cost financially, emotionally, relationally, and spiritually that had the cost to our country. From his emails and much more, we can see the extent of these mandates were unnecessary and not in the best interests of the American people. Americans deserve to know and fully understand how COVID came to be and make sure that this never happens again. Children have been out of school for over a year now. They face irreparable damage because these mandates were put in place thanks to Dr. Fauci's recommendations and selfish actions. The release of Dr. Fauci's emails detailing his views and knowledge of the COVID-19 virus makes this call for his removal all the more important. Among other things, Dr. Fauci was informed that the virus could have originated in a lab in Wuhan, China, before he publicly acknowledged that possibility. All the while, he stood by and allowed President Trump to be demonized for even suggesting that it came from China or that it originated in that lab. China gave us the virus and has left us with lasting effects. The only thing worse than an overpaid, unelected bureaucrat is an overpaid, unelected bureaucrat that doesn't tell the truth. Thank you.
Okay, so that is Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, with an E on the end, leading that conversation. It's good to see, Martin, isn't it, that some of the US lawmakers are actually churning around in order, because obviously Biden's not going to do anything, saying, well, actually, what we'd like is a vote on this in our parliament in order to decide whether or not we can get rid of Fauci.
Yeah, well, Biden has accepted that it may be that it's leaked from the lab. But, of course, none of them are saying that it's DARPA, which is the Pentagon, that funded the research. Now, of course, they say, well, Fauci and that DARPA funded the research and they're to blame for what happened. And, of course, as I said before the clip, what the Chinese are going to say, yes, we know all about that and we think you did it to us deliberately. Now we're going to sink your aircraft carrier.
Well, they're not just going to sink the aircraft carrier,
no,
are they?
No, they're not. And that's why they've been told, that's why the deep state in the US has tried to keep this under wraps. Because what they expected to happen...
They were trying, basically, yes, to pin it on the Chinese. Yes, even Trump was trying to do that.
Yes, they were.
And it's not worked at all.
Well, it has.
It's blown back in their face.
Yes, it's blown back in their face. And, of course, as I've stressed week
in many ways, metaphorically as well as literally.
As I've stressed week after week, the most important piece of information we've received so far about this whole crisis is in the Times of Israel, reporting that the Israeli Defense Force were told in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China. That implies the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States knew it was going to happen, which if you were a police officer, you'd say that's pretty clear indication that of who's guilty.
Anyway, 2 years' time, medical trials of these various so-called COVID vaccines, which really are nothing of the sort. A vaccine for COVID would be the corona, at least this is what we've heard from various doctors that I've spoken to here on this program. A real vaccine would be something called the coronavirus common cold, because it gives you a good deal of immunity to, like, just like the whole relation of the original vaccine, that is cowpox and smallpox, down in Berkeley, just down the road from us here, on the River Severn, and Edward Jenner, when the vaccines were first discovered. What you do is you just stick a bit of a common cold, Martin, up people's nose, and it gives them a very good degree of immunity to the actual coronavirus we're now supposed to be fighting. But they're not interested in that vaccine. They're interested in these man-made mRNA vaccines.
Well, the Pfizer vaccine, as you say, is not a vaccine in the traditional sense. But the Sputnik vaccine produced by the Russians is, as is
still,
the Sinopharm.
Still not approved by Brussels, are
no,
they?
No, no. And of course, when the Sputnik
this
vaccine...
This is political. It's not
about
health.
Of course it is. When the Sputnik vaccine was agreed, it was, you know, the Russians rushed it through and got it ready to use. And they were accused by the West of stealing AstraZeneca's research, to which they answered, and I was on RT talking about this, well, what are you talking about? We've given all of our research to the AstraZeneca team at Oxford University to help them develop their vaccine. And we are trying to produce a vaccine at cost here to help everybody. And of course, the Trump administration then put sanctions on the laboratories in Moscow, which had developed the Sputnik vaccine on the grounds that it was a biowarfare.
Well, the other thing about the Russians is that they actually have got a far better vaccine for one reason, and that is because they've been developing a vaccine to SARS-CoV-1 since about 2003, and so they had a whole load of intelligence about what this SARS-CoV vaccine virus was actually all about. So you're going to get a far, far better deal from the Russians, both financially and in terms of medical outcomes, than anyone else. And yet the EU is still saying, no, we're not having any of that.
Well, that's because, as you know, in the West, Big Pharma has far too much power.
And they're experimenting on people. This is the point, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, we're going to hear now from a guy called Rolf Mengele, and he is the son of Dr. Joseph Mengele. And I was curious to see, what is it about, what was it that drove his father? And also here, what we're hearing here is that what response did Rolf get when he asked his dad, why did you experiment on humans, Dad?
I avoided to speak about in the first days of our meeting. I avoided to speak about problematic points, as it is Auschwitz. Then later on, I came to this. Here, he, as I told you, he exploded hearing this as a question from thy son to him. In the sense, how can you imagine that this is possible for me to do these things? Don't you see at the first line, this is a lie or propaganda or I don't know why. When I then stepped backwards and said, okay, selection, I think this was a fact and was admitted by him very clearly. He excused himself by just saying, okay, I can't help hundreds of thousands if there is such a horrible organization and system. But he excused somehow to say, I helped few of them. I tried to make him clear that even to be in Auschwitz and not to try every day to come away from there is for me an horrible and impossible fact. I could never understand human being can act like this, and it would not change in any position if this is my father or not. It is really for me against all ethic and moral and human understanding and nature.
So the son of Dr. Josef Mengele, the doctor of Auschwitz, speaking there about discussing why he did what he did with his father experimenting on humans. Really talking about selection there, Martin. This is clearly part of a eugenics program, wasn't it? The idea of sort of weeding out bad genes from the human population as the Nazis were doing.
Well, I mean, they didn't really, the gene technology wasn't really that well developed in that era, was it? It's more a question of just carrying out experiments on genetics, people against their will.
Genetics was certainly well known about, and the idea was also there were all sorts of extermination programs to do with handicapped people, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And this was seen as an opportunity with all these captive people to just try various things out on them. I mean, there were experiments on humans where these captives would be frozen in a freezing cold pond, and they were seeing how long it would take to die, this sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, this whole idea of experimenting on human beings is actually part of the Nuremberg Code, isn't it? That you're not allowed to do that sort of thing, and that people have to have informed consent. Of course, by censoring much of what we're hearing about, particularly about vaccines and children right now, you know, this is not informed consent at all.
Well, I think we've got to separate out, as I've said week after week, questions about vaccines, the production of vaccines, the morality of vaccines, and things about, you know, the administrative measures to control COVID. They're not the same argument. They're two different things.
It's experimenting on people with vaccines. That's what I'm talking about there. And I mean, I think it's totally unethical, as we heard. We've heard from various people over the weeks, over the months, that the vaccines can have negative effects. We heard an absolutely horrendous tale last week from BBC Newsround with this woman who, by the way, was a Rhodes Scholar. You know, can you remember her name? The lady from Scotland,
Devi something.
Right? Yeah. She's a Rhodes Scholar, so she's someone who was tapped up at a young age, rather like our Mayor Marvin Rees, to go to one of these big universities and to do a Prime Minister's course or some sort of
She will have been on a scientist course because she's a scientist.
Yeah, but she's a liar. She's saying to all the kids on Newsround that it's 100% safe, the vaccine is 100% safe. An absolutely appalling thing to lie to children like that, because, of course, they're just using the BBC, they're using the mass media to sell vaccines to your folks. And if you haven't worked that way, it's particularly pernicious to be doing it to children when we know that children are virtually immune to having any possibility of dying from or even having really serious consequences of the COVID vaccine.
COVID virus, I think you mean.
Well, yeah, the vaccine is much more likely to harm them than the viruses. That's the point. But anyway, we're going to change tack a little bit now. And our final item is going to be, or second to final item, is going to be looking at Israel-Palestine. You know, as I said, this is one of the big five movements in the UK at the moment, which is a protest movement against the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. And our very own Bristol Nick Georges, he was up a crane in London this week. He's 69 years old, and he says it's one of the most frightening things he's ever done. But as you'll hear here, he's doing it really just to draw attention to the plight and the pain that the Palestinians are going through under the Israeli hammer.
69-year-old pro-Palestine activist climbed atop a nearby crane, carrying nothing but some minor equipment and a large Palestinian flag. Nicholas Georges hopes his death-defying stunt will help raise further awareness of the Palestinian suffering.
It's going to be very dangerous. I'm going to be carrying a heavy rucksack with all my kit, the Palestinian flag up there, and I'm absolutely terrified. I've been so terrified my whole life. But it is nothing to what Palestinians in Gaza are suffering on a daily basis.
Press TV were first on the scene following a tip-off from supporting activist Sarah Wilkinson, who spoke to us from the ground.
He wanted to do something that was compatible with the extremities, if you like, the horrors of Palestine, and he wanted to express his solidarity in a way that had possibly not been done before. So the idea of this death-defying act was to somehow equate the horrors that Palestinians are having to deal with under Israeli apartheid, but also an expression of solidarity in its extreme, and to demonstrate his passion, really, and commitment for Palestine.
This action comes following a parliamentary debate held at Westminster the day before. Despite the demands from over 300,000 Brits to sanction Israel, the UK government decided to protect its relationship with Tel Aviv instead.
This is just the latest example of more radical action that activists and organisations are taking to try and both raise awareness of the suffering of the Palestinian people, but also force a change. And this comes after years of failed action by politicians to force a change to help save lives in occupied Palestine. Robert Carter, Press TV, London.
I've climbed this 300-foot tower crane in the middle of London to tell the world about Palestine. For 3 months, I was sent to Palestine as a humanitarian witness and protected presence. For 3 months, on a daily basis, I witnessed the atrocities and the horrors of the illegal Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. I've seen a house where a family of four were burnt alive by Jewish settlers with incendiary bombs. I've seen land desecrated, olive plantations burned. I've seen so many demolitions of homes, houses, by JCB machines, British-built machines in Israel. Every day, day in, day out, demolishing more and more Palestinian homes. The Palestinians have no rights. Even their electricity and their water is taken from them. Israel is the fourth largest military power, nuclear military power in the world. The Palestinians have nothing. As a Christian who cares, I cannot just stand by and let this go on. And anyone who cares, we should all be doing more to promote the cause of peace and freedom for the Palestinians, and stop the horrors that Israel is visiting upon these people.
So that's Nick Georges, who was on this show a few weeks ago, Martin. He was also at the demonstration against the potential sacking by Bristol University of the sociology professor,
David Miller.
David Miller, correct. And there he is speaking to us from Upper Crane in central London.
Well, it's very admirable that people are taking such a stand. I think
69 years old, yeah. Up the top of a crane. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, we all know that the weaponization of anti-Semitism allegations in the Labour Party and elsewhere, including Bristol University, the annexation of the West Bank is imminent. The annexation of the Golan Heights has already taken place. The US has recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, along with a couple of micro-states like Melanesia and so on. And, of course, we've had the ongoing carnage in Syria with jihadi terrorists basically being supported by our own special forces. So, you know, people want to go and have a nice cup of tea after all of this. I'm afraid they're not going to be, they're not going to get one, are they?
No, they're certainly not. Well, anyway, so what do you make of this new Israeli government? At least there's a new, not necessarily a government, it's a coalition government of some sort, but it's not Netanyahu in charge anymore. He's history, apparently, and Naftali Bennett is now prime minister.
Well, he's another hardliner.
Doesn't happen very often, does it, a change of prime minister in Israel?
Well, it's because, you know, there's all sorts of arguments going on in Israel about who should be in charge, but from the Palestinian point of view, it doesn't make much difference. There used to be a fairly substantial peace camp within Israeli politics, and there are some very good people still operating in that country, but they're very much isolated. But the electorate in Israel have become extremely belligerent, and of course Palestinians don't really get a say in who runs the country, so it's a very limited interest.
More bombing of the Gaza Strip this week, and apparently in response to balloons with fire bombs on them. Is that real? I mean,
well, yes. I mean, that's the. Don't forget that from the Palestinian point of view, the first Intifada, and then there was the Al-Aqsa Intifada. They're basically taking on the Israeli army, who have got snipers and machine guns, air power, and so on, with very limited resources. Although, of course, Hamas in this latest iteration have been able to hit virtually everywhere in Israel, which they weren't able to do before, and ultimately, of course. There will, if there is a major war in the Middle East, which people have got to recognise may well happen, Hezbollah will fire lots of missiles into Israel, and of course, if there's an attack on Iran, they will fire missiles into Israel. So, you know, middle class Israelis who think that they're safe will find that they're not.
The lovely thing is, and it's nice to be able to report this for a change, there were no casualties on either side, and these. Incendiary balloons sparked 20 small fires in southern Israel, and nobody was killed in the bombing. So let's hope that this Naftali Bennett has got something positive.
I don't think anybody should hold out much hope of that.
One of the interesting things about him is he's a tech guru. He ran a tech company for many years, and he cashed his money in. He's got
as you know, the Israeli the Israeli tech industry is extremely, and its military tech industry is extremely well placed. They get loads of contracts from the Pentagon, etc.
Anyway, I thought it'd be nice to talk to Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who's a journalist in London, on this whole topic of the new Naftali Bennett taking over. And I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with him, because he does, I think, a superb job in contextualising what's happening today, looking at the history, taking us back a few years as well, saying this is how we managed to get where we are. But here he is. I spoke to him this week, talking about the new Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, and also the rise of Israeli technology firms, of which Naftali Bennett is a representative.
The rise of Israel in terms of its abilities in modern technological and sort of, if you like, well, abilities, is absolutely astounding. But Unit 8200. Is now a well-known operation or a military-led operation to, if you like, make sure that Israel is the number one in this field. And the fact is that Bennett was a military man himself. He was in Lebanon and was a part of a unit where I think they did massacre something like 84 civilians in Lebanon during the invasion at that time. And, you know, he proudly sits on that record. He was actually recorded at that time during the middle of that war, and it was quite clear that he was pretty panicked, and they did get a bruising. The Israelis didn't do well in either of their clashes with Hezbollah, by all accounts, and they have never ventured back to Lebanon since. But he still hasn't, of course, what I would say is he's not learned his lessons. There's a reality of Israel. It's something like 14 or 15 kilometers from the river to the sea at its smallest point. It has a population of around 14 million Palestinians in that region, which are still there one way or another. They themselves are relying largely on divide and rule tactics because Egypt is a lackey, servile, totalitarian state propped up by the Americans and beholden to the Israeli intelligence, etc. as well. The Jordanians are exactly the same. If you just see what they did over the last year or so, even when the latest king started squeaking a little bit, they immediately propped up one of his brothers, etc., to begin opposition movements. So they control these people, these kind of Arab, if you like, what I call Zio Arabs, really. They're people who largely are there as puppet leaders for the Americans and the Israelis to act as a buffer zone for Israel. To protect it from, if you like, those nations which are averse to it. But the fact is that Israel has borders with Syria, which is not enamored by Israeli violation of its sovereignty with jet strikes virtually every other day for goodness how long, knows how long. It's not friendly with Lebanon. Lebanon is on a war footing at all times with Hezbollah, the prime, if you like, fighting force. Now the Palestinian resistance are finally getting weapons and having the prospect of ballistic missiles or drones manufactured either internally or more likely by the Iranians is no joke. The Israelis have not faced this before. So what Bennett has to really look at is what is the chance of Israel actually surviving in a real war? Because in a real war, what happens, and all the evidence in Syria and in Yemen and Iraq tells us this, high-tech weapons, as ISIS had, funded by the Qataris, backed by the Americans, and logistically supported by the Turks, did nothing to win Iraq ultimately. They didn't hold Iraq. They couldn't. They didn't succeed in Syria. They've been hemmed in a little corner of Idlib, which again is only because the Russians and the Americans have come to an understanding and the Turks have come to an understanding that for now, there'll be a ceasefire. But again, the high-tech weapons didn't necessarily win the day there. Turn our attention to the latest Palestinian clashes. Again, there was no land invasion. Mr. Bennett should remember that Netanyahu dared not do a land invasion because the costs would be far too unthinkable for an army which has never really fought a proper war for very many decades. In Lebanon, when they went in, they lost a few hundred soldiers. That was enough for them. They went scampering back. Their tanks were revealed to be weak. The most powerful tanks in their armory were penetrated by techniques for missile firing, which have got worse. Underground tunnels, mechanisms, tactics of warfare, which Hezbollah have perfected, which have been also passed on now to the Palestinian resistance, without a doubt. All of this tells us that actually a fighting force of 18-year-old conscripts in Israel who reluctantly join an army and have no fighting experience and don't necessarily have the ability to sustain a real war means that they have to think about an option B. And I don't think that the likes of Bennett and these right-wing extremist Jewish Zionists have a plan B. They're still living in a deluded period of the supremacy of Israel, which certainly existed in the 60s and 70s, the late 60s and 70s and 80s. It doesn't exist anymore. There is a new reality. And in this new reality, if it's a military battle that they think they can win, or they can suppress and contain 14 million Palestinians, ultimately, I think that they are seriously deluded, but they're banking on the international community. And by the international community, we know we mean Britain, France, America, and those people who have the veto rights within the UN to bail them out, to make sure that they're never completely overrun. I'm not so sure that even these international powers would ultimately be able to save the Israelis if push came to shove in a direct collision, which I think over the next 5 to 10 years seems almost inevitable, just given the trajectory of the ground, if you like, reality, which now exists.
So that's Saeed Mohsin Abbas, and you can hear the full interview with him, where he gets into a bit more detail about what he makes of this new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Israel. His overall take is likely to have a kind of honeymoon period, but things could get worse because he is more of a religious extremist than Benjamin Netanyahu, if you can believe that. But like I say, that will be the full version of that is up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you want to have a listen, it's about 45 minutes and Saeed goes into a tremendous amount of depth and detail, the sort of stuff that you simply will not hear anywhere else on the Western or anywhere on the Western press these days. Even though, funnily enough, we used to hear this. I can remember back during the First Gulf War, 1990, we'd hear people like Tim Thwellin over in, usually they were based in Cyprus, commenting on the First Gulf War and various tensions in the Middle East. You would hear a fantastic amount of historical background. Now, absolutely nothing. And you know why? Because they don't want you to know any other context. So the idea is you can have a look at this goal, but you're not going to know anything about how the people got onto the football pitch. So finally this week, we're going to go return to this amazing Altian Childs. He's the X Factor winner from Australia video, which is 5.5 hours long. Straight in at the top, I say, of the conspiracy classic charts at the moment. And it's all about how Freemasonry could simply be a cloak for all sorts of cults and secret societies. You remember, you know, people think about Satanism, but there is a thing called the Church of Satan over in the United States, run by this guy Anton LaVey. It's probably been taken over by someone else now. But he got a tremendous amount of publicity in San Francisco, it's based. And he was saying, well, look, you know, if America's going to have freedom of religion, then off we go with Satanism. And, of course, it's kind of taken off. The people that think it's cool to be a Satanist. But anyway, all sorts of cults and secret societies hiding within Freemasonry. That's what Altian Childs' video mainly is about, and about what their agendas are, which we might come to in succeeding weeks. And I've now got a Conspiracy Classics number 9 audio, if you want to listen to it in the car, of the entire thing, because there's quite a lot of long sections of it, half-hour long sections, where all you're getting is loads of pictures of celebrities making these various signs indicating secret symbols of Freemasonry and other cults, witchcraft, etc. And I've managed to get rid of that, and it's now down to 4 hours 20 minutes. That's all it is. So if you're really a sucker for things like this, you can have a listen to all of Altian Childs' stuff on that audio file, which I'll upload at thisweek.org.uk later as our Conspiracy Classics number 9. And so it's some are worse than others, some of these secret societies. But this clip is including, of course, the ultimate from Altian Childs, Satanism.
Well, listen to the founder of the Satanic Church, Anton LaVey, tell us in his book, The Satanic Rituals, which is a companion to the Satanic Bible, Masonic orders have contained the most influential men in many governments, and virtually every occult order has many Masonic roots. This is back in 1972, he said this. Now, 40 years later, it should read all governments, not many. And why is the founder of the Church of Satan talking about Freemasonry, the most respectable and charitable fraternity in the world, that no one seems to talk about and that we never hear about in school? This is why, because the Satanic Ritual is a blend of Gnostic, Kabbalistic, Hermetic, and Masonic elements. That's crazy, because Freemasonry is a blend of Gnostic, Kabbalistic, and Hermetic elements too. Any Masonic writer will confirm that. But how can that be? Because Freemasonry is Satanism in disguise. On page 106, every rite of the Black Order employed Masonic principles. Every rite of these Black Orders, one of which was called Freunden von Lucifer, which translates to Friends of Lucifer. And guess what? There are numerous manifestations of Satanism in Masonic ritual, including the goat, the coffin, and the death's head. Please awaken, O sleeper, and let the glorious light of the truth dawn upon your sleepy eyes. How did Freemasonry get away with this? Just like Jesus, the greatest enemy of theirs, said they would, by dressing the wolves as sheep. A satanic underground carefully cloaked in Christian trappings. That's how Freemasonry got away with it. We can't find out about it because they run the media and the education system clearly. John F. Kennedy was brutally assassinated after he attempted to inform us that we are opposed around the world by a monolithic conspiracy. Did he know that Lucifer was the god of Freemasonry? I don't know. The Grand Master of my lodge, who was the mayor of the city, was a 32nd degree Freemason. That's one short of the top, one short of the true beginning of a secret religion, and he had no idea what Freemasonry really was. After 42 years in the lodge, they never invited him into the 33rd degree initiation, because he couldn't see past the Christian trappings, as they were designed to do exactly that, trap the Christian, or trap anyone else who was too sensitive to behold the truth. Thus, Freemasonry could halt their progress at any time without suspicion, because it's a rare thing to reach the 33rd degree, and every Freemason knows that. So that there are no rude awakenings that take place with those that aren't ready to embrace Lucifer as the true god of Freemasonry and the world. This is an ingenious system, birthed by what must have been demonic inspiration. Anton LaVey says that this ingenious system I speak of serves as a rudimentary screening process for organized Satanism. Exactly right. It's a filtering process, as I've said earlier. An international filtering process from which men and women are picked and permitted to enter the world stage. And I'm saying all this for those who naively think that politics and magic ritual do not mix. That's the founder of the Satanic Church. He admits that. Admissions that were never heeded because no one cares. How else did the Freemasons pull the wool over our eyes? The companion to the Satanic Bible tells us that as well. By filling the world with fools. And who's the biggest fool in the eyes of Freemasonry? An atheist. From the Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. One who does not believe in the existence of God. Such a state of mind can only arise from the ignorance of stupidity. All this time, you're laughing at Christians, and the Freemasons are laughing at you.
So that's Alton Charles there, part of his very, very long, well, it's a superb video. I mean, it's like, I say conspiracy classics, it's definitely up there with some of the other stuff we've been playing, like the long interview with James Files about the Kennedy assassination, the guy that actually killed Kennedy from the grassy knoll, and all the detailed evidence that he gives in 3 hours or so of an interview with, I'm not sure if it was Wim Dankbar or somebody else, whilst in prison, about his incredible tales of surviving assassination attempts by the FBI, the CIA, and the deep state in the United States, obviously trying to kill the guy that killed Kennedy because he was chit-chatting too much. And that's one of the dangers that people that do these political assassinations, etc., for the state run, is that they may have to spend the rest of their life sleeping with a gun under their bed, because what they know about that political assassination may come out to the public, and they may talk about it, in which case, they will have to be eliminated. So you have to do this, apparently, when you're doing an assassination. This is what the Russians say, is that if you're actually carrying out an assassination, not only do you have to do that assassination, you have to assassinate the people that were involved in or carried out the assassination. So it's a very difficult job to do it properly. So that is, Alton Charles, the 4 hours, 20 minutes, audio of the video he's done about Freemasonry and this infiltration of the it used to cover the cults like the Satanists, and there it's useful and very interesting, I think, to hear him detailing some of the things that the Satanists, who are quite open about being Satanists, have said, and how there are organizations and various branches of these cults, death cults, are are growing. And we've even had, I mean, Little Rock, Arkansas, this massive statue of the devil, Baphomet, the idea being to put it up in the town, because they're saying, well, we don't like this statue of the Ten Commandments. We want, you know, in order to have religious equality, if you can believe that, we're going to have the devil up there too. Anyway, so I'll put links to that. I'll put that actual audio, the long audio as well, including the Mohsin Saeed Abbas and the full interview with the Hinckley Power Station people up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. It's time to sign off now, though. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, please just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that address on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got any stories you'd like to share, you think there's anything I've missed or have a correction, please do email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you've got if possible. Download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. I've just noticed a story I should have covered this week, which I will have to do next week. It's all about connecting the same guy who's behind Sage now is the guy that persuaded everybody back in the Blair era to buy diesel cars. And he's a supposed, well, he's basically a Tony Blair's junk science czar, and he's now Boris's junk science czar. So anyway, download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Shadow Band on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My book, after 30 years of research into the origins of the Bilderbergers and links back to the World War II Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback, price £15, including postage, on eBay. A snip, get it, if you like. And my two Siege of Heaven ebooks also around, and you can get everything via Bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make live recordings of the stream. Streaming live from the People's Republic Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Self-censorship and censorship of life-saving information is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, please just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable Sabbath and weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.